Good evening and welcome to tonight's Monroe City Council meeting. This is the regular business meeting for February 7th, 2017. The time right now is 7 p.m. Ms. Atkinson, will you please call the roll?
Certainly. Council members present and establishing a quorum are Scarborough, Cutaback, Hanford, Rasmussen, Davis, Camp, and Gant.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford, will you please lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. First item we have on the agenda this evening is under announcements and presentations. This is item number one, proclamation, James Monroe Bicentennial Recognition. So this request came forward to us by an organization that is not in the area. The request was made that proclamations be read into the record and then sent to the organization as part of the bicentennial commemorating James Monroe, our fifth president of the United States. So we're reading this today, then we'll send this off to that organization so they can have this in their archives. So proclamation, James Monroe, 2017 Bicentennial Year. Whereas James Monroe was America's fifth president and was inaugurated on March 4th, 1817, and whereas after the conclusion of the War of 1812, reconstruction of the Executive Mansion was not yet complete when Monroe became president, and famed architects James Hoban and Benjamin Henry Latrobe worked to restore the White House to its former splendor, and whereas President James Monroe and his family took up residence in the newly restored White House in the fall of 1817, and the building reopened to the public at a gala celebration on January 1st of 1818, symbolizing the end of a troubled past of war and discontent and birth of a new hope. And whereas 2017 is the commemoration of the bicentennial of the restoration and reopening of the White House in partnership with the White House Historical Association, and whereas the city of Monroe was originally known as Ty City and became Monroe when the main store that housed the U.S. Post Office relocated and was called Monroe at Park Place in honor of James Monroe, and eventually the town was known as Monroe. And whereas in the spirit of hope and rebirth, the city of Monroe was named after President James Monroe in 1892 and incorporated on December 20th, 1902. Now therefore I, Jeffrey Thomas, do hereby recognize the 2017 bicentennial of major events for President Monroe, the White House, and the United States as the year of James Monroe, and encourage Monroe's residents to celebrate the namesake and heritage of the city of Monroe, Washington. Thank you, everybody. Next item we have on our agenda this evening is our second presentation. This is coordination of cleanup in city parks and other public properties. This evening we have Sergeant Irving, who will be coming forward to give a presentation. And I believe that Mr. Farrell will be adding to that as well. Sergeant Irving, thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you. Thank you, council members, mayor, City Administrator Mosley, for having me here tonight. I'm here tonight because the mayor invited me and the chief told me I had to come. That's why I'm here. But the reality is I kind of changed I didn't change it. We'll get to that, what we're doing as far as the parks goes, and I'll invite Director Farrell to come up and talk about this. But this is something we've been working on for some time, and that is our homeless response and strategy. And what I can tell you that as a city of our size, that we're pretty progressive in how we've been going at this. And at the direction of the mayor, that we are looking at an embedded social worker this year that will be assigned part-time to the police department. And I'm going to try to convince you why that's important as my presentation goes on and the different strategies we're employing. So as we go forward, we're going to talk about history and what we've learned. So what I've learned in doing this is that previously when we would come across homeless encampments, that we would achieve short-term results with repeated effort. So we'd go down to a camp and we'd say, hey, you can't be here, you need to get your stuff. If it was something we didn't know about for a while, typically the parks department would have a large amount of garbage they would have to clean up and so on. And so what I realized is that I was dealing with the same people just in different locations. And that moving helping the homeless doesn't necessarily solve the issue. People who are in crisis and dealing with substance abuse, mental health issues, and that sort of thing, they remain in crisis, and if you displace them and don't offer them any pathway towards getting off that, it's not usually going to change it. And they simply find a different place to shelter that's unknown to the police. So we keep dealing with the same people, just at a different location. And what I will say is that if you have any questions as I go through these slides, please let me know. I'm happy to answer any questions. Some of the enforcement obstacles that we deal with as a police department is that in August of 2015, the Department of Justice filed a statement of interest, basically arguing that to make it a crime for someone to sleep in a public place when there's insufficient shelter in their city is basically looked as unconstitutionally punishes them. And that was something from the Department of Justice. And subsequently, the ACLU filed suit and basically said to all city attorneys, including ours, and said, hey, you all need to look at your ordinances regarding camping or sleeping in public places, obstruction of sidewalks, urinating in public, and panhandling. If they're doing those things by virtue of there not being a place, you need to look at your ordinances and change them. And we have been given direction by our city attorney, and we continue to look at ordinances that will effectively deal with some of these issues if we don't achieve results through our other program. So, is jail the answer? Not everybody knows this. Some of you may have seen it in the paper, but one of the issues that we run into is that to get someone into jail right now, if they're using heroin or they have a mental illness or something and it's attributed from heroin use, obviously that person requires more intensive care. And I'm sure you all know that the Snohomish County Jail at one point was well known for their in-custody deaths. That was a direct response to changes in their policy that they had to introduce jail restrictions, basically saying if you don't have someone that's committing a violent crime, a felony, or a mandatory booking offense such as domestic violence, you can't book them into jail. And those have been jail restrictions that have gone on for quite some time. And I point out this is because trespass and illegal camping are misdemeanor offenses. And if we can't book them into jail, we have to look at other ways to deal with the issue. Any questions? So, jail continued. January 2017, last month, the jail basically removed restrictions, said, hey, jail restrictions are off. It was a total of 5 days before they sent out a notice saying jail restrictions are back in place. We have no more detox beds. We're only taking in county misdemeanor warrants. That means no new offenses that we deal with are we able to take them in. Detox beds are full. So that should tell you, and it tells us, that there's obviously a bigger issue at play here, is that there's not enough detox beds to get people booked into jail. Those are just things that we deal with as a police department. We have to prioritize who we book into jail. And that's a decision we all have to make. There's certain exceptions where we can ask and call for exceptions, but they have to be realistic exceptions. They have to be justifiable. When we talk about the cost, I'm sure you've all reviewed the jail bills and how they've gone. The cost of a booking fee is $118. If they have a daily medical or a specialty fee associated, it goes up to $151 per day, and then it's up to $229.52 per day for a mental health person. And a lot of my clients, when I say clients, that's people that I deal with, have mental health issues as well. And it may be associated with substance abuse or it may not. So when you look at the cost that we're paying to incarcerate somebody for 30 days, $7,000 for a 30-day incarceration, that seems like a lot of money to me to house somebody in the jail. So we have to look at other ways, cost-effective savings to the city, but also deal with our issues. For those of you who may have listened to my heroin forum, I brought this up because recently before that forum that I presented, individual had thanked us for what we'd done and intervening in his life because he now had a house to stay in, a car, a baby, and he was stable. And he was a drug addict, frankly. And we dealt with him, and I went back, and I realized we had arrested him 38 times. And I wonder how much money we spent on arresting that person. It eventually worked, yes. But if there was a different track that we could have taken at some point, maybe it was worth trying. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But I just bring that up because that seems like a lot of effort, time, and money to get somebody to finally get down to the right direction.
Sir, there's a question from Councilmember Cunningham.
Okay. So what happens when they're in jail? Like, how long are they usually in there? And then do you find that when they get released, they go back to where wherever they were? I mean, what?
My experience, I mean, really how long they stay in jail is really up to the judge. It depends on their crime and ultimately do they have the space to house them.
Right.
I find that most of our folks that we book in for like drug offenses or things like that, their primary mind focus is how they can get their next high. That's what their goal is. It is not anything but that. Let's not confuse it. It is a chance for them to detox depending on how long they're held in, but really, they're really focused on getting that drug. Because when you detox off heroin, you feel horrible. They don't want to go through that again. But unfortunately, they have that addiction personality that they drive back in there. So we're dealing with the same people over and over again. Yes. But really, the time just depends on whether or not the judge wants to keep them in or let them out.
And if you were saying they were full, so if they're not accepting in the jail, what do you do?
We cite and release. So we would essentially give them a citation that says you have a summons to appear on this date, and they would come back before our court on any misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor.
And do they usually come back before the
court? Not necessarily. They issue warrants for them.
Okay.
Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. The misdemeanor warrant, that's new as far as I talked about jail restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
Previously to January, we weren't able to book in misdemeanor warrants just because they didn't have the space or the facilities to accompany these folks. And so it's mandatory booking only, meaning felonies or domestic violence issues.
Okay.
So change in strategy. I think we as a city kind of saw this coming down the pike. We saw what other agencies are doing. This is not our model. Santa Monica PD is kind of the agency that started this all and saying we need to look at embedding a social worker that can take this part of it away from the police. I mean, police aren't traditionally focused as social workers. They're focused on arresting people. And Santa Monica PD said, hey, we're going to try to embedding a social worker, and they've been very successful at that. And so subsequently, the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office is established a unit, so is Everett PD, and I think Linwood's looking into it right now as well. So I think we're kind of on the forefront of that as a city as far as looking at that, and we're going to talk about what we've changed to get there. So as I said, we had very minimal results in the past. We're just dealing with the same people over and over again. And so rather than just respond to complaints, we actively now go into the camps and try to engage individuals. We work to establish rapport, and we try to get them ultimately signed up for coordinated entry. And when responding to complaints that we don't know where the camps are, we first identify who owns the property, notify them of the activity. Some people may be aware of it. A lot of them are. We notify them, find out what their action is. Do they want these people on their property? Is there any type of violations going on? And we try to work with them to maintain flexibility to accomplish the goal of removing personal property and getting the person off their property. Now, what happens is you have to understand is that folks that are living in their camp, their personal property is in that camp. So for you to take that property, that doesn't always make them real happy. So, and a lot of times they leave garbage. So my goal is one, to get them their personal property, and two, I want to try to get them to clean their garbage up. If that means giving them garbage bags, whatever. That's the goal. I want them to have their personal property. I don't want to deprive them of it. And so I want to give a realistic timeline that they can get their stuff off the property. As far as the parks goes, and this is just another thing that we have to worry about as far as the parks, but if we take property, we have to retain it for 30 days until we can dispose of it. So there has been some lawsuits regarding disposal of property in other counties and stuff like that. So we're cognizant of that, and we try to do the right thing.
Councilmember Gamble?
What's a realistic timeline?
Changes. Depends on each situation. That's one of the things that we're learning. I think as we develop more of a consistent programmed approach, we will what a realistic timeline is.
So we as a city, as a department, don't have a realistic timeline. We're basing it based off the individual. Is that what you're hearing?
Sometimes, yes. Each situation is different. It could, depending on who we're dealing with, where the property is, and what their situation is.
What's the longest realistic timeline you've had?
Probably a month.
Thanks.
Yeah, what you have to understand, and we'll talk about programs here, is that the whole goal is to get these people engaged in programs and to try to get them to have a successful outcome. A lot of these folks that have an established rapport, I'm their point of contact. So if they don't have a cell phone, or they do, and they get a phone, if there's a phone call that the housing comes opening, I may be the person that they call to say, hey, you need to go find this person. There's a housing bed available. We've already had one instance where a bed came available and we couldn't locate the individual. We were able to get that person back into a voucher housing program, but that's why we try to do it. And it's on a case-by-case basis. That's obviously something that we'll look to become more consistent on, but it's a case-by-case basis at this point. Chronically homeless. The only reason I bring this up, and you can read through it, is that the Office of Housing and Urban Development is a federal organization, and they define what chronically homeless is. And they are the ones that basically, it's a federal organization that disperses money to Snohomish County. From there, Snohomish County disperses the money to organizations, to their own organizations, whatever, for these types of programs. And, you know, it's a person that's been continually homeless for a year or more, and or to be considered chronically homeless, you must have been sleeping in a place not meant for human habitation, and then you have to have a disabling condition. The only reason I talk about those is when I talk about programs here in a second that we're utilizing. That's important in place. Some of them have that as a requirement, but that's how they assess vulnerability as well. Coordinated entry, when I talk about that, that's a central intake point for different programs used in many different regions. It's not unique to Snohomish County, but information is gathered when we go out at their camp from them. It's a voluntary entry system, and when we talk about establishing timelines and things like that, you know, it's voluntary, but I try to tell them I have a little bit more flexibility if they're willing to work through the system and try to take advantage of some things. You know, if you dealt with someone with addiction, they have to be ready for it. You can't force it on them. So if they're not ready for it and they don't want help, then I can't help them. It's got to be up to them as to whether or not they do it. So when we do that first meeting, we try to set up a second meeting where we have a follow-up. In that second meeting, a housing assessment is completed and an action plan and any immediate needs such as ID, Social Security, or health care needs are addressed to try to give them a pathway. And as I said before, they're prioritized by vulnerability. So that may be something that determines how long it's going to be until they maybe get into housing. There's not enough programs, there's not enough housing. So ultimately, they may be stuck on a list forever and ever and ever. But it's the little things that you can try to repeat and help them out with by having these contacts. And when I say it's little things, I mean that would be our social worker working with them to try to find them a program that works for them. So when they classify individuals into programs suited for their needs, the Housing and Urban Development funds these programs. They're out there. Prior to my obtaining knowledge on these programs, I had no idea this existed or how it worked, and I really had no idea how I would even get somebody into these programs. But the primary three programs we've used so far are short-term housing, rapid rehousing, which is a 3-month to 1-year program. This is geared towards folks that may be living in their car and they're employable, and you're utilizing flex funds to essentially give them, you know, maybe first month's rent or something to get them started on that pathway to success. So that's really a short-term program. Another one is the Shelter Plus program, which we've had a couple successes with this, but it's a shelter program where ultimately it's a voucher that's given to them for their housing. It requires they maintain a yearly recertification for their program to stay in it. And, you know, basically they give them a voucher and say, hey, you've been approved for this much to go out and get housing. Really affordable housing is what it comes down to as being an issue, because the amount they get may not be affordable housing. And a lot of these folks really want to stay around the area that they have family. A lot of these folks have families that are around here, and for whatever reason, it's just come to a point where they can't deal with them, or now they're out on the street. But it's just another issue as far as affordable housing and obstacles that we face. And ultimately, if there's a property management company and they have a bad credit or criminal history, they're typically screened out of the program. So we're asking these folks who have substance abuse issues or mental health to now go out themselves and sell themselves to a landlord and say, hey, take me in, I'm going to be a good tenant. It's not always a realistic model, and that's where I see the benefits of us with a social worker is you can focus on that and helping this person through this process. Another program is a permanent supportive housing, where organizations obtain master leases of properties. They're obtained by organizations such as Catholic Community Services, and there's a case manager on site, and ultimately rent is 30% of income. And this is where that they have to be defined as chronically homeless. And they must meet that recertification each year as well. And when I talk about chronically homeless, the reason the social workers like working with the police and going out there and dealing with them is that we can help establish what that chronically homeless is and how long we've been dealing with this person in the field. The other program is a recovery support program, where it's rehab first, then up to 6 months of clean and sober group housing. It's a one-time only program. And the only, you know, I think that's a good thing, but I think when we look at the reoffending rates of people going through rehab or going off, is that it's a one-shot deal. So you're likely to fall out of rehab or reoffend, if you will, for pretty high likelihood. The modeling of programs have shifted more towards a housing first, as they feel that once basic needs are met, that they are able to go out there, that they're able to navigate through the system effectively. And so it's stabilization through intensive case management focus.
Thank you. Council, I've got two lights up here.
Okay.
The way that there's a light system. Councilmember Cutback.
Where are most of these programs located? Because they're not located in Monroe. Right?
Well,
I mean, where's the closest? I know a family that's homeless right now living in their car, and they might have a home in or a shelter or housing in Marysville, and they don't want to move to Marysville.
Right.
So I can see that that's a problem. So where are the closest?
Well, when I talk about the Shelter Plus program, those are voucher programs where you have to go out and find housing yourself. So that gives the family or whoever it is the ability to go out and find housing near where they want to be, so they don't have to necessarily relocate.
And are there places here that accept that voucher in Monroe?
That's the issue. That depends on the landlord.
Okay.
But
do you know of any that do?
I don't specifically know any of in Monroe that do or don't. So
okay.
That's kind of a loaded question in that I haven't been going out and researching who takes those programs, and I would put that on our social worker or our housing navigator. There are specific housing navigators,
okay. But
due to the demand, their ability to do that is limited as well as to how they can take somebody out and find those places. I think that's one of those things where you establish folks that are willing to help out and do that, and you establish those relationships that will obviously create those openings.
Yeah, it would seem like that's important information for a social worker to know if they're able to give these vouchers out to then say where they could take them, especially locally, to get housing.
Yeah.
Logical.
Just like we have connections, they have a ton of connections.
Yeah.
They know who to call, and that's the whole thing. Is that the programs are out there. There's not enough housing for everyone, but
right.
They know the people to call to find out if this person meets the criteria or not.
Anything further, Councilmember?
Thank you.
Councilmember Scarborough.
And in the permanent housing, do these people have to pass drug tests when they go into some of these programs?
It depends
on what?
The program.
Are there programs, as you're describing, where they have to pass drug tests?
There are programs where you have to pass drug tests, but it depends on whether or not they require that or not.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
So what we've done so far, so we said, hey, or I said, hey, whatever, we all thought that this might be coming and that we need to do something about it. So for those of you who don't know, we have a homeless response group in Monroe. So we started meeting monthly. And we have a lot of folks in the community that want to help out. I mean, we're trying to figure out how can we make an impact, how can we help out, how can we have successful outcomes. So in the summer months, we really started trying to gather a group of us to go out. And so we created a flyer through organizations and Take the Next Step. You can find their information on their website for this flyer of services available. And so we went out and we started trying to do outreach and saying, hey, here's what you can do. Here's some programs. Here's this. Here's that. And what I found out pretty quickly is that that's good. It's a good start. But we really need someone that can get these folks into coordinated entry. Because I kept hearing about this coordinated entry thing. Like, people want to get towards coordinated entry. And so I went out and I rode to the sheriff's office and talked to the Everett PD folks and kind of saw what they were doing and realized we were pretty inconsistent going every month. And in November, I made a partnership with Catholic Community Services, just kind of on a once a week, once every other week kind of thing, where I established a relationship and we'd go out into the camps. We didn't do a great job of keeping statistics, I will say that. And it was kind of one of those things of, well, we don't really have any statistics, so let's go in the system and see what we can pull out. So we came up with and since November of 2016, we've contacted 22 individuals. And I would say that's a pretty good number of folks that we regularly contact in camps in the city. I think that's pretty accurate. Some of these folks we've contacted multiple individuals. So we try to go up and engage regularly. And what has that led to? Ultimately, if 9 have enrolled into coordinated entry, 13 have declined, but as recent as last week, two of those 13 have contacted me. And when I talk about they're not ready, they have to be ready, they're tired of this, they want to do something. And 4 have received either treatment or housing vouchers. So 4 doesn't seem like a huge number, but that's 4 folks that are not out on the street, that are not in camps. So for just doing it, you know, once every other week type of thing, that's 4 success stories if you ask me. So we hope to make that a bigger number, I guess.
So, Mr. Scarborough?
So you're telling me that we have only 22 homeless people around town?
No. I'm saying that 22 is a pretty good number of people that I'm regularly finding camps at.
They're the regulars.
The folks that I know where they're staying. There's some folks that literally I've seen when I talk about those second appointments that we have. If I've got my behavioral health specialist who's working with me that's meeting with folks and somebody doesn't show up for their second appointment, I may see somebody that I've never seen their camp and go, I know that person's homeless, and I'll say, hey, you want to come down and talk to this person and get enrolled in coordinated entry? And I'll do that. But 22 is really the number of folks that I really kind of know where they're at and know where their camps are.
And when you go looking for people, do you not go into the county or the state property?
I've gone to the south side of the bridge once to take a couple different groups down there, just as a law enforcement liaison. It's not in the city, but I went out there to give them the opportunity to get people into coordinated entry, because I know that it's pretty close to the city. So that's the one time we've gone out of the city to do that, but it's just on that one occasion.
And the state property out by the church?
Yes, I regularly go there.
Behind the Goodwill?
Yes. Anyone else?
Ticket.
So where we're going, we're in the process of obtaining a contracted part-time social worker that will be embedded with the police department. The focus will be to navigate individuals in our community to successful outcomes. This social worker will not only work with our homeless individuals, but people that may become homeless by virtue of having substance abuse issues, or people that, you know, we deal with in drug houses that are going to be homeless because they get kicked out of their drug house. The social worker will also work with our courts. I know that our court has already done it on one occasion, and I know they're willing to do it. But if we have someone that's currently incarcerated in the jail, and there's a program that opens up for treatment, the judge is willing to release them into treatment. And ultimately, that may lead to a better outcome, and it reduces the cost of the city because we're not paying for a jail bill. When we get to the point where we're talking about what we're doing as far as cleaning up our parks. One of the things that we've agreed upon as a city is that the Parks Department will conduct weekly checks of city parks for illegal camping and provide the information to the police. And notice will immediately be given. I think that it's a direction as a city we've decided is zero tolerance for camping in city parks, and so we're going to be pretty quick to react on those type of things. When we talk about the parks and areas of focus, I'm going to ask Director Farrell to come up.
Thanks. All right, good evening. If I can figure out how to make little red dots appear on there. Or is this just the...
Oh, there's our green dot. Sorry, I didn't mean to shine in the
light. I should look at the color of that.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. So, Alan Borland Park. What I want to do is just clarify what the park boundaries are. And so, just to start off, all of the light green shaded areas is City of Monroe Park. Gray area is not. And where you see the woods all along here, that's not either. So if any of you have come through, you may have come through Simons Road and then driven down into the park. When you come over here, you'll see there's a sign that says Al Borland Park. So a lot of people would think that everything around here is Al Borland Park, that's City Park, and it's not. The sign's located in the right-of-way. However, private property exists on both sides of the road there, and another private piece of property exists on both sides of the road there. When you cross over Woods Creek, the bridge, then you're actually entering the park. So that's just, you know, something to be said there. So when we get reports or some things up in this area and the railroad right-of-way area where the old trestle remains are that went across the river here, then the police are contacting these property owners to deal with whether it's trash or whether there's someone camping illegally there. This is another railroad right-of-way. I guess in older times, we had another trestle going this way. So you see the gray with the white dots and whatnot. We GPS'd this about 6 years ago. So these are all fairly accurate. I'd say along here we've had some erosion issues as we do seasonally with floods, so this may have changed a little bit. But it's that main roadway coming down. When we talk about the parks, doing checks of the parks weekly, daily, this is the roadways driven, cans checked at both ends, that sort of thing. So weekly what we're going to be doing is making sure that every week we're running through all of these maintained trails, which we have been doing, but then all of the just footpaths that are made in, you know, the parks department, you know, these aren't park created, you know, trails in here. It's just more just people have done that. You know, whether that be people wanting to blaze some trails or, you know, or just hiking or something in the woods there. And this is all, of course, as you know, all floodplain area. You know, all of this area is subject to flooding. So what we're going to do on a weekly basis is we're going to run through foot trails here. So if we notice something in here, again, like, you know, the property owners could be contacted. Going over this way, Lewis Street Park right here, and down along here is the State Fish and Wildlife boat launch area. Ding. Yeah, here we go. So we're going a little farther downstream. And here's Sky River Park in the light green shade. So Fish and Wildlife, so if there are any issues here, then they would be contacted. And then this is the Cadman property site. So there are issues back in here as well. You know, the current property owner, of course, as you know, this will be transferred over to the city, so this will become City Park eventually. So, I think that about covers the park area. Yeah.
Thank you.
So when we talk about the police department as far as their areas of focus and where our camps are, I just kind of want to point out kind of where most of our camps are that folks are at. This is all
and the area in red that I'm kind of trying to outline here with my shaky hand is all DOT property. That's the area behind the Seventh-day Adventist Church and stuff like that. And, you know, it's a large wooded area, and people are traditionally move around up in there. And then you talked about the area behind Goodwill. That's over here. And then right here, there's this little chunk of land that's owned by Washington State Parks, and then a continuation of DOT down here. And then this is private property landowner right here. And I can tell you that one of the things I commonly heard was, this person said I could stay on their property. So I've had to educate some folks as well, is that it is not their property. But and then the other common thing I hear is, well, where am I supposed to go? And I don't have a good answer for them, but I just have to tell them that the property owners requested you not be here. I'm trying to work through some outreach to get you in the program that'll work for you, but ultimately you're trespassing and you can't be here. So that's kind of the difficult spot. And in case you haven't figured out, it is not a popular position to be in, depending on where people fall. You either want to help them or you want them out of your city. It's not a popular position. But I have to try to appease both sides, and I have to try to work with my clients to build successful outcomes. So it's all about strategy and trying to find something that works. Takeaways from my presentation. So consistent outreach and enforcement will lead to better outcomes. We talked a little bit about consistency, what the expectations are. I think we'll figure out what's too long. I can tell you in my personal experience, I've already learned what too long is in one location, where I've decided it's gotten out of hand. There's too much garbage or whatever here. You guys need to clean up the garbage. You need to get out of here. I mean, that's one of those things we learn. And we have to change as we figure those things out. You can't build rapport by just showing up and saying, get out, but hey, listen to me, I want to help you and try to get you in the program. It doesn't work that way. You know, you may not agree with it, you may, but ultimately you have to establish some rapport and try to get folks into a program that'll lead them into a pathway to success. The programs are out there. We need to get someone who's knowledgeable in them, that has the ability and time to focus on just these programs and our clients out there, that takes that, alleviates the police department and that, and helps us. Ultimately, there's not enough housing available, but the goal is to try to help as many people as we can and go from there. The other thing I just wanted to point out is that you'll notice that all of our problems in the city are heavily treated areas, and the reason people go down to the parks and things is because it's a good place to hide inside of their camp and keep it undetected. And we advise homeowners for block watch or crime prevention through environmental design that we have to change. You need to change this or change that to create more visibility. I simply propose that we look as a city as our parks is to the environmental design and the ease of access for our parks folks and us to detect when camps are down there. And I just ask that you think about that. So that concludes my presentation. I want to thank you for your time. And does anybody have any questions?
Council members, do you have any questions? Council member Hanford.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. First of all, I want to thank you for what you're doing. I love to read about and hear about the different adventures you're going on and taking on this huge undertaking. I think it's great to see, you know, our city's been, for the police department, it's been kind of well known for being the first of things. We were we took on red light cameras. We took on body cameras. That was the new thing. And we're taking this on. I think the thing to do, I think it's the right thing to do. And if we're going to try and be the first on something, this is something worth being the first on. I wanted to say also the housing first model, you're right on. Outside of city council work, I've done some studies on that and heard lots of reports on that and read lots of reports, and that's exactly, we're on the right track as a city. That's what we need to be focusing on. I love the embedded social worker model. I think that's definitely the way to go. I think with the judge that we have here in Monroe, that's who will be hearing those cases, right?
Correct.
So our judge has a solid background, a solid head on her shoulders. She knows what she's doing. She has talked about these kinds of issues and not just throwing people in jail and just going by the book, but by being creative and trying to help them with their lives. So I think we have all the pieces in place to really make this a success. The one question I have is, where is 211 in all of this? Is that so being utilized, or?
Yeah, so 211 is kind of how I kicked the establishing the relationships with the actual organizations that can do our coordinated entry. So 211 is your central coordinated entry point.
Right.
And someone can do that, and it's a very cumbersome process at times. I know the first time I called, nobody answered. And that could be a fluke or whatever. But essentially 211 is where this central intake point is, and it's supposed to be the place that we track homeless camps in Snohomish County, and so you're supposed to call this number to report homeless camps. So I said, great, I'm calling to report a homeless camp, and I know where it's at, and I actually want some help in going out there and making contact with folks. And so that's kind of how this started, is that I'm kind of bypassing it in a way, and that I don't want to call from somebody's campsite necessarily. 211 also gives us access to flex funds in the field. If we run into someone on a specific need and we're able to get them housing for a night or something, it's a one-time deal, but it may assist them for the night to get them somewhere they can get some other services.
Great. It's great to hear. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Councilmember Kent.
Thank you. I want to echo great job on explaining it very clear. But I'm curious about parks and environmental development. So what kind of issues are we dealing with? You can't effectively go out and clear cut our parks.
Can't do that.
Do they have any plans for eliminating whatever the brush or whatever they're using on?
Unfortunately, down in Elk Roland Park along the river, there's really not much we can do as far as clearing areas. Aside from our existing trails and roadways, we can keep little buffers along the sides, that sort of thing. But we wouldn't be able to really open up, like, I think, say in a neighborhood park, say you have some bushes that are becoming overgrown and they're creating hiding places. There's something we can do about that, to open that up, remove the bush, or something like that. But in a wooded, forested area there along the shoreline, there's really not much we can do. But I did want to add something I didn't mention is that our crew, we're stepping up our efforts to follow all of those footpaths. And if you recall on that map, we have 14 other parks we're taking care of, and yet Al Borland is the one that has the most territory, especially when you're following these footpaths and whatnot. So what we really need help from, too, is, and this has helped us tremendously in the past, is any citizen, if they notice something, is to please call us or email us directly to the city. If you look on our website, and we're really easy to find, and just report what they find and where it is, and that really helps us tremendously, because our staff, as much as we want to step up and do it weekly, we're not going to be on top of, we're not going to notice things, just as Sergeant Irving mentioned, as far as known encampments, these people, they want to really hide and, they don't want to be seen, so it's difficult for us to our crew to discover everything. So.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thanks. And on that note, you will have seen that Al Borland Park is a couple hundred acres, right? And it's
about 90 plus acres.
About 90 plus? Okay, so about 100 acres, give or take. And one of the things that we might benefit from, and I know that we're you know, we've had on the books to do a master plan of the Cadman site for a couple of years now, but one of the things we might want to do is actually prioritize the parks that we do have and maybe look at doing a master plan for Al Borland Park. I saw in the news just earlier this week and overheard at my other job where an RFP had gone out for somebody to do something out at Payne Field Community Park over by Payne Field Airport. They're doing a high ropes course. And, you know, that's one of the things that we might consider doing is doing some sort of RFP following a master planning process that might bring in some sort of event or some sort of infrastructure that would be appropriate for an area that gets flooded frequently. So you bring people into those areas of the park right now that don't get a lot of interaction with the public. So, you know, that was one of the things that occurred to me was it would be cool if we could attract like a high ropes course out here. There's also been talk with the property owner to the south, on the south side of the river, at least that I've heard, where they're interested in selling the property on the south side of the river to another entity. And that entity might be the type of entity that might be approachable to have public use of that property. Well, you could take that master planning concept and maybe try to do a master plan with the southern property also, and you could envision perhaps a zip line from Al Borland Park to the other side of the river and back again. So my whole point, again, these are fun concepts. My whole point is we may benefit from having a master plan done of Al Borland Park to try to bring more eyes into the park. And that's something we'll talk a little bit with staff about over the next couple of weeks and maybe bring back to council and see if that's something they're interested in. So anyway, Councilmember Scarborough and then Councilmember Rasmussen.
Could you provide Liz a copy of your presentation tonight so I can have a paper copy?
Absolutely. Thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you, Sergeant Irving. Thanks for coming out. I had the privilege of hearing you speak about this program as well as the Summit County Sheriff's and RPD speak of the same program. So I'm excited, and when I heard the opportunity of this coming to Monroe, I got really excited. I thought this was a great direction for us to head and benefit our community. The thing that does concern me, however, in listening to you speak tonight and previously as well as the sheriff's, is it's very clear that we don't have enough housing, affordable housing and beds in place. And with it seeming like more and more cities of realizing that this is a good direction to go and the success that this potentially does have, it does concern me that this puts a bigger emphasis on our other problem of not having enough housing. And so I don't know if the cities ever in the county that have a little more experience or tenure under their belts with this program, if they started to proactively adopt or move in the direction to address that part of the issue, or kind of where that goes. But if not, I mean, certainly here in our own community, this is definitely something that we want to take a serious look at. So, I don't know if you...
I mean, I think it's been in the paper Everett's looking at. I think it's a 70 housing. They're doing things like that. And I know, so if you look at the sheriff's office programs, my understanding they do the treatment only first option. That's what they primarily pretty much put all their people into that. And I know in listening to them speak and talk is that I think they've had like 40 some successes that have graduated the program and relocated, which is pretty good. And one of the issues that they run into is the bottleneck, is getting people screened and that sort of thing. And that happens when you have a system that wasn't traditionally built around people doing outreach and going out and generating clients to build them on this pathway to success. Obviously, you're going to have a huge influx of folks, and so I think we all have to look at that and what programs can we help. And, I leave it to the current social worker that I've been working with to find the program, and they get screened out because we're not. We don't look at one specific program. We look at a program that best fits them. We don't do treatment only first. So I think that gives us a little more option, I guess. But I think you're right on as far as the programs out there and housing.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Councilmember Gamble.
Yes, thanks, Sergeant Irving, for being here tonight.
that a lot of ways I don't envy you. I know exactly what you're talking about, because there is, we need to be fair, but we need to be fair to residents and to these individuals that you're trying to help. So I guess the piece that I'm really looking for is, we're going forward, and I appreciate your candor and honesty on AA. You know, we're figuring this out a little bit as we go. But if there's anything that I have learned, is that numbers drive decisions, and they drive investments, and they kind of drive us what path to go down. So I was happy to hear that, you know, in the process, you talked about, hey, we didn't have statistics. Now you're starting to track that. What I would really like to see, was going to bring it up later tonight, is really kind of having some sort of, it is a crisis. I'm just going to call it what it is. Some sort of operating rhythm going forward as a city, where, you know, well, the chief wants you here tonight, but I want to see this on a monthly basis. I want to see our ongoing efforts, our plan that we have put in place. Director Farrelly talked about calling in. I 100% agree. We need to get more aggressive with making, you know, in the parks, whether it's through signs with a hotline number. We have a hotline number that's specific for calling in and reporting illegal camping or whatever. We can pull statistics off of that number as opposed to just going through the main number that may or may not be, you know, written down, or we lose, you know, some of those statistics, something in that regard, where we have signs posted. Timelines for clear, I mean, we need to be clear, firm, and fair, you know, to your point. Or really, you know, timelines around taking action of some sort, whether it's, you know, through entry and or otherwise. But I do think that when we let it go on for too long, it's not fair to the residents, you know, that are having to, they're living in the, you know, in the city, and they know that if they threw a piece of garbage out their window, they would be paying a fine. So really, that's what I'm looking for. I mean, there's so much good stuff in here, and I really applaud the efforts and what we're doing. But I really do think that from here forward, it needs to be a concerted, you know, effort from all of us up here. It's great to hear that we've got a, you know, coalition, and we have citizens, and I can see it on social media that are sent forward. But we're tracking the number of incidents that are reported, and I'd love to see in the statistics there where you had, you know, those that had been in entry, those that were refusing, and really, hey, what's the progress as we go throughout the year? Because you know, the last couple of weeks, it was probably a good thing we had as much time as we did in between the last council meeting. But the amount of walks I took with my dog and through the woods, I just kept getting more upset and being yelled at by the individuals for invading, you know, their area when I was just walking through the town of Mica. It really upset me. So I appreciate all the work that is being done, but I am absolutely want to see more of this. I want to see regular frequency. I'm hoping that I'll get some support in that, because I think it's the only way that it gets better. Is that with the continued focus, and you know, yes, we have a housing, you know, the beds thing. Well, you know, my experiences is the only way that we get to a point that where you find a better, you get investment there is when you have statistics to back up the investment. So,
right. Thank you. So what we'll be doing with staff is we'll go ahead and take the comments that everybody has had so far, putting the responsible panel, and see what we can do to come up with better statistics and follow up on that, see if there's an opportunity for a hotline and so on. And just so that everybody knows also, we've been working on this issue. We've made this a priority over the last couple of weeks. There is garbage from abandoned camps, if you will, in particular along the Highway 2 bypass. The PD, Sergeant Irving, I think you had reached out to the Department of Transportation about the garbage on their property. Also, Sergeant Irving and I went out and viewed that property about a week and a half ago, so I actually toured some of those sites. But he reached out to the Department of Transportation and also to the railroad to have garbage removed from their property. DOT was going to be out today. Because of the weather, they were not out today, but we're expecting them now out next week. So they will be coming and removing garbage from their property. The railroad also has indicated that they would be out, and I'm looking at the chief, to pick up garbage in on their property down adjacent to Al Borland Park. And from PD to the parks crew to our director, Mike Farrell, to our chief, to Sergeant Irving, to our interim city administrator, our whole team, and me, our whole team has been working on this for the last 2 weeks, very much focused. I also met with the property owner on the south side of the river to talk with them, and also to talk with County Council Member Sam Lowe's office about the issues that they, Paul Peek is her name, that she's experiencing on the south side of the river there. And there was a lot of communication with her about what it is we do and what it is we don't do, and who the right contacts are. So anyway, I just wanted everybody to know that we've been working the issue for the last 2 weeks, and I'm looking forward to DOT taking care of their material. And again, I thank the staff for all the work they're doing. Lastly, I want to point out something. We have before us a sergeant today that's been working on social service issues. And that's one thing that, with the different things that he was talking about at the beginning of the presentation, we all need to realize is that he's a sergeant. He's trained in law enforcement, and he has found himself, and I'm speaking for you, I guess.
Sounds good.
If I'm telling you, if I'm saying the wrong thing, you've got to pay for it.
It's not an invitation.
But the thing is that we have somebody that is trained in one area, and what we need is somebody that's trained as a social worker to do the work. The council has made the right choice to invest in a social worker here. And the chief is working on that. I feel strongly that when that person starts spending time here, that we'll be able to make better progress on everything from getting people help to maybe helping to coordinate charities in town that are providing help to people in need. The goal here is to get people to shelter and to actually get people to take the next step, to take a hand up, not out, to improve their situation. It's not to keep them where they are. And that's the goal of the Embedded Social Worker Program. So we're hoping to have a contract before you in the next couple months. And again, I've given direction to the staff to go through the property on a weekly basis just to try to catch stuff as they develop a lot more quickly rather than finding out that something has developed over a couple months or something. It's harder to take care of at that point. So, Sergeant, thank you very much for coming and presenting this evening.
Thank you.
The social worker is part-time. Where's the other part going?
The Department of Chief of Police. The Chief of Police is working on that right now. They're meeting with the Human Services Department at Snohomish County tomorrow about the other half of the FTE. There are a couple of options they're looking at. He'll then be back for you to give you an update. Okay. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda, which is comments from citizens. This is a time set aside for members of the audience to speak to the City Council on any issue related to the City of Monroe, except any quasi-judicial matter that is subject to a public hearing. Do we have a sign-in sheet? Thank you. The first person that we have who signed up to speak this evening is Mr. John Steinman. Mr. Steinman, welcome.
Thank you. Do you have to say your name and address?
I have it right here.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
1 minute on what I was going to speak on, and then obviously the homeless, I have to say something. The trash, I got my bill in the mail, and I'm disappointed. I'll just put it that way. We've gone from 1 month, now we're billing ahead of time for 3 months, and I know it's been in the, I'm sure it's been in the thing that's been there. I probably haven't paid attention as much, but I'm concerned from a fiscal standpoint. If they go bankrupt, we're billing at least a month and a half to 2 months in advance. What happens if that happens? They've got our money for that long. I'm not exactly sure why we agreed to something like that, but I'm sure you guys are more aware than I am on that. And, you know, it really kind of does front load this and really doesn't help us with the new garbage thing. And I called today to try to talk to somebody there. I tried twice, and I was on hold for 10 minutes twice, and I just finally gave up. So nobody's picking up the phone over there. I call here, you guys respond within, you know, two or three phone calls. With them, you know, I mean, if that's going to be the service we're going to get, then, I mean, I guess you don't know. I mean, I have it in your seats. I do understand, you know. So I don't know what they sold you beforehand, but I think it's, anyway, I just want to bring that to your attention. I'm sure you've been getting flooded with phone calls. Anyway, as far as the homeless people go, obviously we have Monroe Gospel Women's Mission here in town that we have taken 18 women off the streets, thank them a place to stay. We have a transition house here, so we're definitely looking at trying to help that out. We've been going about 11 years now, and we've taken 1,100 women off the street. 40% do greatly improve their situation. I realize you guys are dealing with families and men and different things like that. We strictly just deal with women, but we're full every night. I mean, so we're down at 450 South Lewis. We have a transition house on Short Columbia, so we want to see that help. Sounds like this would be a good program to help out with. So I am being brief tonight, but appreciate your service, appreciate what you're doing here. But I am coming back to the trash issue as I get done. I guess I'm just kind of a little disappointed with the contract itself. And another thing that used to be, if the thing came up a little bit, the trash for the commercial for our church, that I've never been charged at all for that. They would just take it away and that was fine. Now if it's not down, I've already been billed $33 extra, which is almost more than the actual fee itself that it was before. So it sounds like the service is being cut and the billing ahead of time. So I and no response when you do call. So I'm just making you aware of that. Not here to be upset at anybody, just but I did take my time to be here and to let you know. So thank you very much.
Mr. Stein,
thank you.
I'm not going to read the entirety of your phone number. Your last four digits, though, I just want to confirm. 1955?
Correct.
Okay, cool. Mr. Mosley here, our interim city administrator, will be calling you to follow up.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. The next person who we have who has signed up to speak this evening is Mr. Michael Lorio. I'm sorry, sir.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much to all of you for your all the time and doing this. I want to say a special thank you to the Monroe Police Department, also for all the work you've done. My name is Michael Lorio. I'm a counselor at Take the Next Step. I'm also the night manager at the emergency cold weather shelter. So I like to think I do have some experience in the discussion tonight. And I could spend a lot of time talking about the resources that are available to us here in East County and how much of a struggle it is to access those resources. To answer your question earlier, about 2% of our clients get housing in our area. So it's a real issue for us. But what I wanted to focus on tonight, apart from wanting to really commend our police department and the heart that we've seen from them in the last couple of years, is to really endorse the idea of the embedded social worker. I'm sure we can all agree that the homeless issue in our community is a real problem, and it's a growing problem. I think we can all agree that none of us have the goal to stabilize homelessness and to make it something that's consistent. Our goal is to help people find real change in their lives in order to find better circumstances. One of the things that Sergeant Irving didn't discuss, and he did such a great job of really covering the topic, but one of the things he didn't discuss is the trauma of homelessness. And I think we can all agree that if you were homeless, you would find that to be a very traumatic experience, regardless of why it started, regardless of where you find yourself in your situations or what coping mechanisms you develop to deal with homelessness. It is a very traumatic experience. And in those situations, what you find is people begin to lose the life skills that we take for granted in order to take the steps that need to improve their situation. So whether it's being able to keep appointments, whether it's being able to have dialogue with the people that they are meeting in a positive manner, and all those simple things that we take for granted, relationship skills, are all things that are lost more and more throughout the spectrum of being homeless over a longer period of time. And it is a very broad spectrum. I got permission from these people. Three of the people that have been staying consistently in our cold weather shelter over the last month are elderly. They qualify as elderly, and they are homeless right now because they cannot find housing. So it is a broad spectrum. But to go back to that idea of that trauma and those life skills, the difference, the dramatic difference that an embedded social worker can make is that relationship and that consistency, that ability to establish that strong personal relationship with somebody who lacks trust in the greater social network, and that consistency to be able to connect with them and say, hey, you have an appointment on Wednesday, hey, you have an appointment on Friday, and be able to come back to them and help them develop, again, those skills that are needed to take those real steps. So we believe that it's going to have a dramatic impact on our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lorio.
Thank you.
Next person we have who has signed up to speak this evening is Pastor Michael Hanford. Pastor Hanford.
Thank you so much. I, too, want to thank our police, our chief, deputy chief, Sergeant Irving, and all the officers. As a chaplain, the last 15 years or more, I've ridden along, and I've been an observer of how they interact with the community and with the homeless and with those that are needing to be arrested or trespassed or whatever. And I can say that I have always seen them to be professional, greatly concerned about justice, but also merciful and polite and kind and yet tough. I mean, they're tough and tender. What can I say? I've also sat on the retail theft group for a while, so I've seen that aspect of the homeless who are in trouble many times. I am a member of the Homeless Response Group, which was a group that was started to really get everybody on the same page, the coordination that we heard about from Sergeant Irving with the county, with all the different agencies, and the faith community, different ones. I've been involved with Sergeant Irving to a measure, going out to the camps, trudging out in the woods and in the blackberries and all the rest. And they really do, they're just models. They're just incredible. They're really seeking to arrest anybody who needs to be arrested. I mean, when they come into a camp, they're kind, their approach is so professional, but their eyes are open. If they see paraphernalia, if they see this and that, they're going to come back and deal with it. I mean, they're not like, I mean, they're tough, and yet they're tender. So I want to, as well as Mike Lorio did, as we've studied it together and seen studies, this concept of the embedded social worker, we were there when the Snohomish County Task Force came and spoke for a couple hours and shared about their approach with their social workers there. It was incredible, good results. And those four people and those people on the stats that we saw, and I agree we need to keep those stats coming, those four, can't tell you how much that means that those four are no longer on that downward spiral or at the bottom. So thanks for all your work, and God bless you all.
Thank you, Pastor. All right, is there anybody else who would like to come forward to speak to the City Council on any issue related to the City of Monroe? Anybody at all? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to the consent agenda. I'm sorry, Councilmember Scarborough.
I'm really concerned about this gentleman's comments about Republic, because the whole idea that we agreed on when those people were talking about splitting this contract up was customer service, customer service, customer service. 1% discount that you're going to see in your bill overall, overcharging when the lid's up this far, that far, that far. Those things were never brought up from Republic when we talked about that contract. And I think we need to address that. I'm sure you will, but I really want to find out about that more.
Yes. And what we will do there is Mr. Mosley will follow up with Mr. Steinle. I'm sure that he will then follow up with Republic, and then he will send an email to the council and advise them of what he's found.
Could I ask one more question?
Yes, sir.
Was the charge that you got for 3 months excessive to what you thought it would be, or what it may have been in the past for 3 months?
Actually, it was just early. The charge that I was talking about, see, I'm a pastor of a church, uh-huh. And then we have the mission, and then we have my own personal. So I had four different bills that I was looking at. So it was, but the $30 was the first time the church had ever been charged, $33, that much, and we had the same amount of trash, basically. So anyway, so it's only billed by the month in the commercial setting.
Okay, thanks. So, thank you. Councilmember Gamble.
I would be interested when we do that follow-up on that. I know when we went through that discussion, specific questions were asked about service levels in regards to their call center support, and they went in depth in regards to call handle time and different statistics. So I think it's a reasonable request based off of those proceedings that we should get some sort of report. Since the bill, we've gone to the quarterly billing, what is their call handle times, average speed of answer, all that kind of stuff, and get some service level metrics from them, as they said they could provide. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Excuse me, everybody. We're going to go ahead and move on to the consent agenda then. Council members? Would somebody like to make a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Make a motion.
Councilmember Rasmussen. Sorry.
Oh, I didn't push my button.
Motion to approve consent agenda.
Second.
Okay, I have a first from Councilmember Rasmussen, a second from Councilmember Scarborough to approve the consent agenda. Any discussion on the consent agenda? Saying none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 7-0. Thank you. Next item that we have on the agenda this evening is new business item number one. This is AB 17025, Discussion, Snohomish Health District, Proposed Interlocal Agreement. And would this be Mr. Mosley?
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. Last year, as you were in your budget deliberations, you considered a request from the Snohomish Health District regarding a per capita funding request increase, which the council asked that increase be included in the budget to $2 per capita funding for the district, which it was. We now are preparing, we're now proposing an interlocal agreement for the purpose of increasing and changing that per capita contribution from the city. You have for your consideration tonight two interlocal agreements. One is as presented to us by the health district that would constitute the $2 per capita rate, and a second one that was prepared by that with some amendments that were prepared by our city attorney, and so I would invite our city attorney to share the thoughts of those amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Lowell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. The changes are relatively minor in nature, Council. A few of those go to the requirements of the state statute that authorizes intergovernmental contracting. In the first instance, they prescribe a few form and content requirements that I've tried to track with my proposed provisions. These are things like designating either a joint administrator or a joint board to serve as the contract administrator official, providing for some mechanism of termination, although I agree that given the duration of this contract and its context, the likelihood of actually using a termination clause is probably fairly small. There are also some changes to the insurance clause, which I think was probably just misdrafted in the first instance. The original draft uses the term consultant. I think it may have just been cut and pasted from someone's professional service agreement template. That's my guess. I originally tried to just modify that to bring the terminology into a consistency with the rest of the agreement, and then the more I thought about it and talked with staff, and keeping in mind that the agreement would be between two public agencies, presumably both of which have membership in either the WCIA insurance risk pool or the AWC pool, some other type of public agency oriented insurance coverage. I simply eliminated the insurance requirement altogether and indicated, as you see in the revisions, that that provision would be satisfied by membership in a risk pool. I think there are a few other very minor boilerplate changes, but the bottom line is it's a fairly low-risk contract, and these changes I don't think should cause any heartburn on the other end of the contracting ledger. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the council might have.
I do have one question for our city administrator. Do we know if any other cities or the county has entered into this interlocal agreement yet? Are we the first ones that are entertaining this? That would be one thing that, if you don't have the answer today, I think would be beneficial. There's something to be said about being first or not, perhaps in this case.
I can find out for you.
Perfect. Thank you. We'll go ahead and take lights now, and then you'll continue with your presentation. Do you have any further presentation?
No, just that the question for this evening is kind of which of these two versions of the ILA does the council wish us to bring back for a final reading the next evening.
Okay. Sounds good. And as part of that, if there's any substance, obviously we'd like to hear that too. So, Councilmember Kadebeck.
Just had a question about the term. I want to make sure I understand the addition that the city attorney put in there. So if they make a material breach and we let them know that we failed to material breach and they have 30 days to cure, they don't cure, then at that point do we say you have 30 days and we're canceling?
Correct. That's
okay.
How this
so
is.
It could be up to 60 days before we cancel. Okay. Just want to make sure.
And again, Council, just to reiterate the point previously made, the likelihood of an actual termination in this context is very small. It's just one of those form requirements that the State Interlocal Cooperation Act technically requires.
Thank you. Councilmember Gamble.
When you bring it back, it'd be for a first reading, not a final reading, correct?
Right.
This is just discussion.
Right.
Okay. Just making sure. And the other thing, I know we still haven't put a bow on the other.
Right. That's a separate issue.
It's a separate issue.
But what I'm saying is that
I am reluctant to go into any additional agreement until we resolve the other. That's just my personal opinion, because we're talking about entering into an agreement with an entity that we had an agreement with before that we can't prove what happened to interests and documentation. So I would like to be able to do that first before we enter into another agreement with this particular entity.
Yes.
My thoughts.
Do you know if time is of the essence on this? Is there any reason why we couldn't delay effectually council taking final action on this until, say, the end of February or middle of March, so that the Rucker building could be resolved first?
I'd look to the finance director for that. My my thought is that I'm sure that the payment will be retroactive to whenever the agreement date here is, so I'm not sure there's a, but I'm also sure they'd like to get their money as soon as they can, so.
They can just not make the payment until an agreement is.
Right.
All right, thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. Zach, I appreciate you taking a look at this and really tightening it up for us. I think it looks much cleaner for us. And, you know, the record building discussion in this are, you know, all with the same entity, I think, are two different matters, but yeah, I feel confident that the discussion that we're going to have on the 21st with the record building will clarify a lot of the questions that came up at the last meeting. So, you know, based off of reading this and the knowledge of the record building, I feel pretty good about moving forward with our attorney's recommendation revisions on this to the next step of having the first reading be scheduled later on in the month. Certainly you can do it the same day as the record building discussion, just because I think it's, again, two separate things, and a lot of that's been buttoned up, or is being buttoned up on both sides.
Thank you. All right, Councilmember Cutterback and Councilmember Gamble. Okay, Councilmember Gamble and then Councilmember Cutterback.
Yeah, no, I understand that it's they're two separate, but it's with the same entity. The clarity or the thing that's consistent is we're looking at an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where the crux of the issue is for me, is that we have an agreement, we have a dispute, or what do you say, a dispute, we can't find the associated documentation to say, hey, you know, did we put $20,000+, which seems like a significant, you know, so that's really what I'm looking at, is that I really would have a hard time voting in favor of a new agreement before we can even prove the last one that we had. Again, they're two different things, but the commonality is an agreement between the two entities of the Snohomish Health District and the City of Monroe. So before we enter into a new one, we want to make sure that we're on in good terms in that regard. That's basically what I'm saying.
Do you mind, ma'am?
No, go ahead.
And I get what you're saying. I completely do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my point is that I think the discussion that we're going to have on the 21st, you know, is going to clarify a lot of that up. And, you know, keep in mind it is both sides, both entities that are having troubles finding that information. So, you know, I personally feel confident enough that, you know, based off the information that we're going to get presented on the 21st, that it'll satisfy a lot of those concerns. That
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's great, but you've got that confidence. But I mean, we had statements that were made that it doesn't exist, and now, you know, find it. That's great, but the documentation didn't exist. I get it. If we get it on the 21st or whatever, that's great. But I'm not going to sit here and say, hey, I'm for it until I know that's all.
Anything further?
Nope.
All right. Councilmember
Cutterback? Well, I was going to say, I agree with the red line version, so when we do bring it back and I hear what you're saying, it is two separate agreements, but I would say let's finish the conversation on the Redker building. This is not a time of the essence. It will pay the full contract, so whether we sign it in March or whether we sign it in February, so I would just say that to be safe, you might be confident those questions might be answered. They might not be for other council members. I don't know. There was a lot of unclarity before. So I would just say we bring back the red line version. We bring it back in March. We let this other situation settle out. And I don't think it affects this contract whatsoever if we sign in March. So, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So that's what I would propose.
So I'm going to flip one more question out to council. So if we take a look at the scope of services on page 206, and we're one of only maybe two jurisdictions where we've agreed to the $2 per capita. Mm-hmm. That includes people that are up at the Department of Corrections. And so we have here an ILA where we're agreeing to pay $2 per capita, and then 3B, responsibilities of the district, says the health district will provide basic essential public health services and functions, dot, dot, dot. They're already providing those services, right? So when they came in here before, they were talking about wanting to do an ILA to provide additional services. Well, they're already providing these services. So one of the questions that I have, I guess, for staff, to what extent do we need to have an ILA, or can we just contribute money to the district without an ILA? I guess one of the concerns that I have is that if we enter into an ILA where they agree to provide us services that they would already otherwise provide to us, it seems weird that we would enter into an agreement where we would be paying money for services in the scope that we're already receiving, that's all. And I don't want to set the expectation or the precedent that if we decide not to, the council decides not to pay this in 2018, that somehow somebody says, well, we're not going to provide these services to you that we're already supposed to be providing. And I would add to that that some of these services that they provide, I think they're compensated by private applicants. As an example, inspecting septic systems. I'm just guessing that to inspect a septic system that an applicant, you know, a property owner pays the district an inspection fee or something like that. So I just want to make certain that when we identify the scope of services, yes, we're agreeing to give you $2 per capita, we're going to put this in writing so that there's some predictability. How much, if anything, do we need to put down for the responsibilities of the district? I guess that's a question. Mr. Lowe.
Council, just from the legal standpoint there, I think it's actually very important that there's a contractual linkage between what we are providing public City of Monroe dollars for and making sure that there's a contractual obligation for this other public entity to actually provide a service, that the city's taxpayers are getting some enforceable obligation as a result of that. And I can't speak to the other funding sources of the health district and whether and to what extent the district has a legal authority or obligation to otherwise provide services, much less services at a particular service level, to the City of Monroe. But I do think that linkage is very important for audit purposes, and that's why I would recommend some form of an interlocal contract to establish that relationship.
Okay, and it's okay to identify services that they're already providing to us with or without the per capita?
I think it's a very valid point. Perhaps the approach would be to acknowledge in the document itself that this is not establishing any sort of future expectation or any diminishment of the district's statutory or other legal obligation to provide these services. It's the funding that you're providing is essentially an extra, and the quid pro quo for that is their additional contractual promise back to the city to fulfill that.
I'd feel better if we could tease the language out just a little bit more so that it addresses what you said right there, that this doesn't set some sort of expectation that we're going to continue to do this and that these may be services that they're already providing, or, you know, they came in here and asked us to help them out financially and we said yes. And they said that they'd provide us with additional services, and there's nothing there, although there is the one sentence that says additional specific services provided by the health district to the city may be developed jointly by parties. Of course, that might be by another ILA with an additional contribution from us or something, because it's vague enough. But anyway, so we'll see if there's some additional language that we can provide there for bookends or what have you, if that's okay with council. Councilmember Hanford?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me take Mr. Mosley first and then Councilmember.
No, why don't you go first, because I was going to try to summarize and move us on.
Sounds good. Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, that was one of the ideas that I had, too, is that if we can make the language so that this just happens to be a one-time gift. If, you know, in the future it happens again, great. But so that we make it clear in the language, this just happens to be a one-time gifting of city funds to help the Sonoma Shelter. And however the verbiage is, you know, you'll know what it needs to say. But the idea coming across very clearly that this is a one-time funding from the city, and the flip side of that is that in no way should that affect or change the existing services in future. You know, should, like, next year if we don't fund things like that. Just spelling it totally out there so that there's no misconception about, well, you're expecting, you know, that the services are going to continue in a certain way for a certain amount of time. So, just echo support for your...
Thank you. You know, there is some argument that can be made that there are some cities that are only doing $1 per capita. There are just maybe two of us that are doing $2 per capita. An argument could be made that maybe we should have an extra voice at the table of the health board. You know, we should have a little bit more of a weighted vote, for example. And I don't see that written into this contract. I don't know if that's important right now to council, but certainly if this became a multi-year thing, it might be something that would be important.
I propose Councilor Gamble to the board. Be that way.
Yeah, because right now our representative is Councilmember Rasmussen, who just happens to be a City of Monroe council member.
Yeah.
But in the past it's been Councilmember Guzak. You know what I mean? And here we are, we're doubling up, and other jurisdictions are maybe doing a buck or nothing, and they still have the same level of voice on the board. Yeah. Councilmember Cutaback, and then Mr. Mosley, plus another councilmember.
Just one last comment. I hear what we're saying about telling them to keep continuing to provide basic service, and by us not funding them next year, if we choose that to contribute, that they will still provide this. But the reality is that if public funding for the health district continues to go down and continues to be cut, they can't make that promise that service will continue. They might not be able to say that. That might be something that evolves year to year, depending on their budget, what they get from the county and whatnot. So if we don't provide this funding, services might stay the same the year after, but it might be cut. So I just want to put that in there that, you know, I think they would be hesitant to say that whether we get the funding or not from you, we're going to provide the same services. So that's just my thought of having sat on health board, you know, a few years ago. That funding has always been an issue that most counties and states, cities do help fund their health district. It's not funded just from the county. Cities do chip in. They do not chip in Snohomish County until they're asking for this now. So it's just something to consider that basic services might be cut in the future without additional funding.
Thank you, Councilmember Cutaback. Councilmember Scarborough.
Do we, somebody explain to me still why we're paying $2 a head for the gentleman on the gated community on a hill?
They're part of our population. It was a legislative action. Council could certainly decide not to fund the $2 per capita for the Department of Corrections. It's completely a legislative decision. Councilmember Gamble?
Yeah, I would entertain
that.
Okay.
It's about 1,600 population or so, times two.
I think it's 2,200-ish.
That's even more.
What is the population of the jail?
For our prison?
Around 22-ish.
We have to go look at it.
Well, I think it's higher than that because it's 2,700.
Yeah, 25 times.
It's getting bigger and bigger.
We do get state shared revenues based on the population. Also.
We get other things because of that.
You don't pay.
Okay.
Well, we don't get the property tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Would be an interesting comparison.
Anything further, Councilmember Scarborough?
No.
Okay, Councilmember Gable?
No, I didn't. So we get, I guess my question would be, is the health district actively involved with the folks that are incarcerated in the prison, providing services?
Yeah,
probably.
But maybe DOC needs to chip in.
It's completely a legislative decision, even though the appropriation is there.
The outbreak wouldn't be the CDC. It'd just be the health district.
Depending on what it is.
If the case of TB breaks out up there, the health district's going to be the one to manage it, and not DOC, not necessarily us at the city. It's going to be the health district because that's what they do. Just as you know, the TB case was to break out, there was some residents in the home or. You know, the situations we had with Sky Valley, you know, that same thing was to be up at the prison. If the health district would be working with the DOC instead of the school district. So, I mean, so yeah, they would address those health concern areas just as they would with any other entity within the district that they serve.
So why don't I do this, because we could probably talk about this for a while, and this is something that can be amended in the contract when it comes back for final, you know, for first reading and then for final reading. We'll get some more information about the population of the prison. We'll get some more information about what the Snohomish Health District does up in the prison. And like that, we can at least do the calculation. If nothing else, we can make an adjustment to the $2 per capita to do 36 to 240 less the population of the prison. Seems like a pretty easy thing that we can amend when it comes back. Does that sound good, everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mr. Mosley, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. If I'm reading the sense of the council from the discussion here, it seems to me that the proper course that the council would support would be to have the Rucker Building on the agenda for the 21st, which it currently is, and bring this back for consideration, assuming we adopt something with the Rucker Building, bring this back for consideration on the 28th with some of the questions and issues here in the agenda bill so that you have some understanding about that, and that the ILA that would come back to you would be the attorney's version. If I have that correct, then we can do that.
Okay. Sounds like we're good. All right, we're going to go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda. This is new business item number 2, AB 17-026, discussion petition for waiver, MMC 12.12.03 of sidewalk requirements, natural factors, TI application number 3622. Mr. Feilberg.
Thank you, sir. The natural factors, as you are aware, is out there on Brandless Boulevard, the large building, the big bump on the roof. They have some storage in the building immediately to the south, which is just north of Cascade Community Church. They are doing a little bit of revising wall inside that building to close off some areas for their storage of their materials. There will not be any people coming and going to that. The cost is approximately $4,000, and our Middle Municipal Code requires that all building permits the property have sidewalk installed unless they ask for a waiver from the City Council based on a nexus of proportionality. In this case, it's not generating pedestrian trips, and the cost of the improvements is approximately five times more. The cost of the sidewalk improvements is approximately five times the cost of the building improvements. So we feel that it does not meet the nexus of proportionality requirements for us to require them to install that, and recommend that the City Council grant them a waiver from the requirement to install the sidewalks along Brandon's Boulevard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Powell. Councilmember Pam.
Thank you. So they're not changing the outside of the building, not expanding it. They're just making some modifications inside of it.
Correct.
Moving some walls.
Yes.
All right. I'll move to waive the requirement of constructing the sidewalk along the public right-of-way frontage along Friends Boulevard associated with building permit application number 3622.
Second. We have a motion from Councilmember Camp, a second from Councilmember Davis for the requested action in agenda bill number number 17-026. Any discussion on the motion? Councilmember Gamble.
The, I think all of that makes sense to me. The actual, what they're doing internally is just moving walls around?
This is putting a devising wall up, yes.
What?
A devising wall.
A devising wall?
Yes.
Turning two, or one into two?
Yeah, basically, walling off a portion of the building for their use.
What is it currently? Is it just storage?
I think, well, it's vacant right now. So it's been a variety of manufacturing and storage uses over the years.
So it's vacant, now it's going to go to two rooms instead of one?
Yes.
Okay. Is it going to increase the occupancy?
No.
All right, Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. I mean, it makes sense to allow for this waiver given the cost and what they're actually doing. I guess from my standpoint and being one that walks down there, it would be nice to find a way to connect the sidewalk from, I guess right there in front of Pisano's and connect it all the way to the corner of Ty and Freiland's there at the Y. I mean, it, one, it makes sense, but two, I mean, as much foot traffic as we have around there, it would be nice to have a sidewalk on that side. And so I guess if there's a future plan for that, love to hear about that. Or, I guess I would be hesitant to get to giving on future waivers if the projects were going to be a little more intense than just moving a wall on the inside. So,
thank you. Councilmember Kent.
I'm sorry.
I did say Kent.
Thank you. So I'm just curious, is there like a minimum amount where we would start considering additions like this or some kind of development? I mean, it's a $4,000 change that they're making, which is going to add a wall inside an existing building. I mean, I could see if they're adding some major construction or something like that, it would make sense if they wanted to have us review it for a waiver. But have we given any thought to saying if it's less than X dollars, a waiver can be automatically applied or something?
No, the city council put this in a while ago. It used to just say they had to do it. With no waivers, they had to do it. They just said if you get a building permit and you're commercial or industrial, you have to put sidewalk in.
Okay, I've heard of that. I've seen it in a situation like this.
And I don't have a code in front of me, so I can't tell you what year we changed that. But it was late 90s, I do believe, that someone called about, complained about the nexus and proportionality of making people do improvements for minor projects, right. And at that time the council wanted to be involved in the decision of whether or not the waiver was granted.
Okay. I would suggest that council may want to consider that as a procedural change in the future. We might want to set a standard for a minimum amount before we consider whether or not they have to request a waiver as opposed to just have to apply. Something like this, I hope it's not delaying, but I hate to see any businesses delayed in their development if it's something like this. Just some thoughts. Thank you.
Actually, just for the delay issue, the code only says that the sidewalk has to be installed prior to the certificate of occupancy.
Right.
So, we issued the permit and said you can't get a certificate of occupancy until the waiver or the sidewalk is installed.
Okay, so it's not a critical issue.
Yeah.
You may want to consider. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Kovac.
So I too agree a sidewalk there would be wonderful.
I agree with that.
But I also agree that based on this construction project, it doesn't make sense to have a company pay 5 times what the project is costing them, and it doesn't impact traffic and all that. So I agree with having the flexibility to request a waiver. My question is this something that we would ever, and I understand the council back then wanted to be the one that got involved in this and helped make the decision. Would this ever go to a hearing examiner, or is it too small?
I had the exact same conversation with Mr. Feilberg today.
Okay.
This, I think, predated my tenure as city attorney.
Yeah.
But my recommendation, if the council is considering a code amendment here, would actually be to designate either the director or the hearing examiner as the official to consider waivers of this type, because it's essentially related to a building permit, which is supposed to be a ministerial, checklisted, very basic decision process. Not typically the type of thing that you would expect to go to a legislative body of 7 people. That said, it's certainly the council's prerogative to retain it in its current form if you'd like to do that. There's certainly no requirement to that effect. And then just real briefly to Councilmember Camp's comment regarding the desirability of some sort of a dollar threshold here. As counterintuitive as it is, the legal standard, the nexus and proportionality test that Mr. Fowler was referring to, doesn't really hinge on how much money the developer, the building permit applicant, is spending. The real crux of the question is, what is the impact of that development on the city's need for a new sidewalk? And sometimes those are completely disjointed. Sometimes they fall into place perfectly, and there's a direct correlation between how much a developer is spending on a particular project and how much the impact is going to be on the city's transportation system. But the legal test, the test that this code section is attempting to track, really looks at impact a lot more than expenditure.
So if I may, if they were building $100,000 dividing wall, that would still...
Same test.
If
there's not going to be a meaningful traffic or a pedestrian traffic increase as a result of that project, the fact that they would have spent $20 versus $20 million on the wall wouldn't really be relevant to the ultimate impact.
However, and to that point, whatever would be applicable, I just don't want to see them go through a delaying process coming up before council for a waiver for something like this, which uses the director of order hearings here.
That's what we're coming back to the board.
Well, I just think we might want to consider, you know, putting it forward to the hearing examiner, as long as it doesn't add additional time and expense and all that. I don't know what that would do, just to take it away from, you know, us making that decision.
My recommendation would be that as part of the code rewrite that we will be doing this year, that's one of the things that we look at is having things like this go to the hearing examiner. That makes sense to me.
I would hate it if it took more and more time, though, and delayed a construction project to an unreasonable point. Or I know we put a charge on people paying for a hearing examiner. I can't remember offhand what that was. So just some things to consider.
Okay.
That was it.
Thank you. Council Member Hanford.
Thanks. Yeah, that was my question, and I guess I still would love the answer to is, so if you put up a wall, no matter how much it costs, what is the possibility of them now subleasing that to another company that, say, a restaurant that now you want a sidewalk out in front of? And that's kind of what I'd love an answer to before I just say, oh, yeah, go ahead. I mean, as much as if it's just natural factors and it's just going to stay that, there's no possibility of putting in any other establishment that actually is going to need a sidewalk, then, yeah, this all makes sense. But if they're going to do something like that, this is a great example of what we don't want to waive because there may be a need for that in the future.
Mr. Feilberg?
The assumption is that they did something that would generate a large amount of pedestrian traffic that they probably need to get another building permit. And then once again, even if it's for a small amount, there's a nexus there that says they're generating large volumes of foot traffic, so they would be required to do it again.
Okay, so there's
so you have that risk all the time, though, that you know they can do something that attracts a lot of people without changing the building, but you never can tell.
But it sounds like there's a fail-safe net for down the road if that were to happen.
I was just going to look up. I think it might even say change of use, but I'm not sure about that.
Sure.
He's looking that up. Sounds like Councilmember Gamble's got a similar question or something. So, and then we'll come back. You've still got the floor and he can
sure. Okay. Councilmember, we're on the same wavelength.
I'll yield.
Because my comment was that, you know, is the waiver, I mean, we're waiving it because there's not going to be a change of use or occupancy, but if they go through and then all of a sudden there is, and we can prove there is, then are they, you know, in violation of the waiver? Is there any way we can put something in the waiver that is contingent upon that? Because then that would address what we're talking about. Because the other, beyond subleasing it, if they were to sell, and then the new owner, you know, hey, it's two rooms. They may have a use. They may have a use for the building, but it's still the same in the same use category, but would have a higher, you know, occupancy per se. So that is my question. That some way we have built into the waiver that, you know, hey, we're waiving it because of these two reasons that have been spelled out, and if in such a time where it comes that it's not, then you would be required to put the sidewalk in.
I think the answer to that is presumably elsewhere in the code, where presumably it gives the director, whoever the decision maker is, on that future permit, that a change of use, there's a CP or another building permit or an occupancy or whatever, would be able to condition that specific future permit in order to mitigate the impacts that would accrue from that future decision.
Mike, I guess mine is in the light, I get that. The piece that I'm talking about is permit enforcement, right? I mean, we provided a permit, are waiving this, but then the use is not what they, you know, is before us. Because if they don't submit a building permit, how are you going to know?
Well, I would assume that anything that the property owner would do in the future that would actually generate an impact would require some future city regulatory approval, some future permit, license, some type of formal document that the city would issue that would authorize that change of use, that increased or enhanced use. And I assume that somewhere in our code there's a provision that authorizes the director to condition the city's approval of that future project, that future change, on any number of measures that would mitigate the impact, and that may very well include the installation of a sidewalk, but I don't know offhand where exactly that would be in our code or whether the city would be simply relying on its inherent governmental power to do that. I'm happy to speak to the staff about that after the meeting.
All right. Back to Councilmember Hanford's question.
No, the only time is the sidewalk or walkway shall be constructed on the public right-of-way for any purpose as a condition of a building permit issuance. And then the only time the certificate of occupancy is requirement for the sidewalk is when it's a single-family use in a business or industrial zone. That changes from a single-family to a business or industrial zone. So from when commercial use to another commercial use without a building permit would not trigger the requirement for sidewalk in this section. So just, you know, there might be somewhere else that we have to look to see if there's something else that would require that.
But if I understand the council's concern, it's just to make sure that this waiver doesn't become a sword in the future to exceed its original intended scope.
Essentially, that, you know, all of a sudden we're getting phone calls and you know, you've got an backlash that there is an increased occupants and traffic based off of this particular action that they took, and then, well, we've already, you know, waived it, right? That, you know, that's all. I get it. It makes total sense to me. This is the right thing to do. It's just that if to Councilman Hanford's, you know, point, if it was sublet or if it's sold, you know, are we tracking it just based on natural factors, or is it tracked based off of Rylands Boulevard, you know, that we have this waiver that it is based on these two things, and if, you know, going forward it changes, then we would go back and seek for them to put the sidewalk in, because the action that he took did actually increase the traffic. That's all, and it's more, you know, intended just in, you know, in general, as we're talking about. And I also agree with the hearing, you know, going to a hearing examiner. I think that makes total sense. But it just seems like there's a hole. That's all.
Yeah.
Councilmember Hanford, you still have the floor.
Thank you. Yes. So I would love to see that language in there that says something about that this is a waiver based on the approximate same usage, or however you will use the verbiage, before I would vote in for this, because of the reasons that we've spoken of.
Is there an amendment to the motion to resolve that issue?
So if I could, Council,
yes.
Briefly, the building permit applicant in this case basically vested. He locked in, or she, whoever it is, locked into the framework that the city has adopted locally, which includes this version of the code. So the change that you'd be referring to would be kind of prospectively applied to future applicants, people who came before you in the future and wanted to get a waiver. Changing the rules in mid-game as it relates to this applicant is probably something that I'd recommend against.
Okay, so we can't say yes, we'll waive them as long as blah blah blah.
Well, that's a different question. My understanding was that you were asking about changing the code, changing the format,
changing the motion.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the code that would limit your ability to condition that, as long as it was objectively fair and constrained to that approach that you were referring to.
So there is a motion on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, if somebody wants to, they can make a motion to amend the motion to add bookends, or this can be tabled, or the motion can be withdrawn, and staff can go back and see what sort of additional language can be added to address some of the concerns that we've raised tonight, to put bookends on here, rather than try to come up with an amendment to the motion here. So before you answer that, is there anything, Brad, on this, that there's any sort of time frame that we couldn't wait until February, the council couldn't wait until February 21st?
I don't know where they are in their project, so if they're, you know, there's a semi-truck coming that needs to fill up that building sometime, they want to have a certificate of occupancy. I don't have that information.
Okay. All right. So then the question comes to council, do you want to make an amendment to the motion, or do you want to rescind the motion? Councilmember Hanford.
So, yeah, I'll give up the floor in a second here. So I'd love to hear from other council members on this, because we've only heard from a couple so far.
Okay. So I'll just go ahead and recognize you're giving up the floor now. Councilmember Gamble, go.
I really have no problems voting on this. It's the right thing to do. It really is. My question is speaking to the point of the enforcement of the waivers, right? I mean, we're granting a waiver and then just ensuring that we've granted the waiver, and that, you know, it truly was for the reasons as stated. That's really where I'm at. I'm fine with voting on it. It's the right thing. I'm just was just kind of noodling around the question. Well, you know, hey, what happens if? And these two points that are in their letter are just simply false. You know, what recourse, you know, do we have? And from what I understand, what I'm hearing actually, you know, now, is that if we're waiving them based on these two items, wouldn't it just be code enforcement at that point in time? If we could basically, I mean, it's a question for the attorney.
Well,
once you've made a waiver, I mean, that's limited to the specific request that this applicant made with respect to this particular project. He's essentially asking you, in light of the fact that his project is not going to have really any impacts, whether you're going to agree to waive a code standard that would otherwise require him to install a sidewalk in front of the property. Once you've voted to do that and that waiver becomes effective, that issue is basically settled. If that applicant or some future owner of the property at some future point either came in for a new building permit or some other change of use that triggered the sidewalk requirement in the future, that requirement and any waiver from that would be looked at on its own, evaluated on its own merits. It wouldn't be so much an issue of code enforcement as it would just be application of your existing standard. This waiver is specific to this applicant's specific request in relation to this wall.
I get what you're saying, but that's not exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So for this wall, what I'm saying, if it's this applicant, I'm not talking about, you know, we talked about several of the sell and sublet, all that kind of stuff, but you know what, I'm okay. It's the right thing to do. So,
is there any other discussion on the motion? Okay, we'll go ahead and call for the question then. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes 6-1 with Council Member Andrew voting against. Thank you, everybody. All right, we're going to go on to the next item on the agenda. This is new business item number 3, AB 17027, ordinance number 003-2017, amending MMC 20.05, critical areas, first reading. Ms. Restall.
Good evening, this is Shannon Hustle, and I'm here with the city. Pardon me for a moment. Regarding wetlands, and wetland mitigation. It's on my and that would be amendments to chapter 20.05 in the municipal code. So primarily, this particular ordinance has been a long time in the making. And so it was actually written with the assistance of the Department of Ecology. And then we sent the draft ordinance to Ecology, and someone there made corrections and sent it back to us. So the last time we spoke with the Department of Ecology regarding the proposed corrections that are the proposed revisions that they suggested was in November of 2015. And several things that they added in were increasing the buffer widths for category 2 and 3 wetlands. We also have incorporated Department of Ecology mitigation measures and ratios. So, come back to that in a second. And more information about that, I believe, is on page 3 of your agenda bill. This is just a quick timeline showing how we have met our process requirements. Something of note I will point out is that we sent off this amendment to the Department of Commerce on August 18th. And we did, like I said previously, we had been working with the Department of Ecology, and the Department of Ecology had requested that we not be granted expedited review. So we actually had the full review period with the Department of Commerce, which ended on October 18th. And there were no state agencies other than Ecology that provided comments. Ecology provided a comment letter actually regarding our SEPA threshold determination on September 9th. Okay. So just to get a little bit more information about those comments. The first one was regarding the water typing system that we use versus state law. And we actually use one that's in the WAC in 222-16-031. Might look familiar. It's the one, it types streams based on numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There is a new typing system, I say new because it's been around for a bit, a new typing system that is based on letters, as you can see, F, S. And there's a table actually in your agenda bill where I compare the two. And what was recommended was that we adopt the new system to provide consistency with the state system in neighboring jurisdictions. Okay, so at this point, that was a comment on something that's not proposed to be amended in the code at all. So just putting that out there, we're not even looking at streams at this point. It's all about wetlands. And we currently, as I said, use the system in 031. We're not required to adopt the new system until the Forest Practices Board adopts new fish habitat water type maps, which hasn't happened. So there's not a requirement yet that we change to the new system. Eventually, we will be required to adopt it. And when that happens, one thing that I wanted to point out is that we may have to update our current stream inventory or even commission a new one. So that would be an added expense for the city at that time. And because this is not something that we're changing at this point, this comment doesn't really apply.
Councilmember Cuddeback.
Can I just ask a question? So if we were to adopt that, even though it wasn't one of our proposed amendments, if we were to adopt what they're recommending right now, then we would currently right now have to do the stream inventory, and that would cost us money.
At that point, we would have to make, we'd have to look at the new stream categories and
categorize all of our streams in there.
Yeah.
And so that would take time, and about how much money would that cost? Because eventually we will have to do that. We will be forced to do that.
Right.
So is there a reason not to do it now? Is it a big expense in time? Is that the reason why we just wouldn't do it?
The only reason I can think of is that it might not have been budgeted for this year's work plan. But other than that, I mean, I can do some research.
No, I just was curious because it sounds like eventually we are going to have to adopt it. So if they're recommending it just now or later, what's the difference?
Right.
That's all. I was just curious. So fine.
And to be completely honest, our previous inventory was done quite a while ago, so we might want to update that anyway.
Yeah. So that's all. I'm just curious. Okay.
So the second comment is probably the one that was most impactful, and that's the buffer widths that we are recommending in our code amendments are not consistent with best available science and a publication that came out in June 2016, the Wetland Guidance for Critical Areas Ordinance Updates, Western Washington version. And your agenda bill has a discussion of best available science. There are two volumes that are available to local jurisdictions that were put out by the Department of Ecology, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and a few other state agencies that contain the most updated best available science. There was an update actually put out to those, I believe, in 2013. And on top of that, the Department of Ecology uses those documents for their tools and resources. So to ensure that if you're a local jurisdiction, you may not have the resources to actually go out and figure out best available science for what you're proposing, so you can turn to Ecology to get that information. Okay. Wow, that's really small. So United States, the wetland guidance for CAO updates is a DOA publication based on best available practice. And what this does, it's a little bit different than what we've known in the past. It provides two options, so you have a little bit of flexibility in determining the width of wetland buffers. So your first option would be it's shown in table XX1 in that document, number one. And table XX1 is going to assume that you're using minimizing measures in table XX2. So if you look in this particular document, there are three tables in a row, XX1, XX2, and XX3. So because it's assuming that you're using mitigation measures as prescribed by the document, it's going to have smaller buffer widths. And so you can see that down here in the chart I've provided. So, you know, for Category 1 wetlands, you are required to provide 75 to 225 feet versus 100 to 300. The other option is to use Table XX3, which does not assume any mitigation, and therefore the buffers are wider. And after speaking with Mr. Gresham, who is the gentleman who provided the letter to the city, we both agreed that Table XX3 would be less onerous on Monroe residents, because if you wanted to do basically anything on your property that it, you know, you happen to have a wetland or a wetland buffer, in order to show that you're preserving the function, just a regular resident of Monroe might have to provide a critical area study, which is rather expensive. So if you go with Table XX3...
I'm sorry, they have to provide what?
Oh, I'm sorry, a critical area study?
Oh, thank you.
And so if you go with Table XX3, that is built into the wetland buffer, that any sort of reduction in function, degradation of the buffer. And so we agree that, like I said, Monroe is probably best served by Table XX3. And if you look, the city proposed buffers are on the right. We're well within what is being proposed by ecology. What we are proposing is within that range for XX3. And when I spoke to Mr. Gresham, he stated that he would like to see us provide wider buffers. I know this is not reflected in his letter, this kind of a he said, she said thing. But he stated that he would like to see us provide wider buffers and that he couldn't enforce that. So, just to give you an idea of what this would look like, I have a few back pocket slides. So, first and foremost, this is what we have right now. The purple that you see, the blue are wetlands, and the purple around the wetlands represent the current buffers. So you can see there's Category 1 down the southern part of the city, and you know, Lake Tai doesn't have buffers. Skipping over, so if we were to go with the proposed buffers, I have a comparison of what that would look like for the city versus DOE buffers. And please keep in mind, of course, our maps are to be used as a guide. This is not an absolute resource based phase one. But the city's proposed buffers are in the lighter purple. If we want DOE buffers, they're in the green. So you can see what the difference would be.
Shanna, we have a number of lights, so before we move on to the next topic, I'll go ahead and take those. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. You actually answered my first question, which is, what is it now and what would it look like? The other question I would have to ask would be to our city attorney, does this in any way affect any litigation you're currently involved with or may be involved with in the near future?
Council, my recommendation would be to address that in executive session rather than open session.
Thank you. Thank you. Councilmember Gamble.
Can you go back to the table that you were at before we came in?
Sure.
So, my question is in regards, I get the XS.3, 100 feet to 300 feet, by standardizing there, you don't have to do a critical areas study if you were going to, you know, put some sort of, you know, building or development within those buffers. But it would, would it be safe to say, though, that it would restrict the ability of a homeowner or somebody to be within 75 feet, which is actually, you can do it, but you need a critical area study. Is that correct?
That's correct. To show that you're meeting those mitigation measures in table XX.2.
Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is if we go with XX3, mm-hmm. 100 feet, that's it. There's no, you can't do a critical area study now and make it so that it's only 75 feet.
It's assuming no mitigation whatsoever. So, but that doesn't, so the code already contains provisions to allow for the reduction of buffers.
That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, and that's actually the next thing we're going to talk about.
How about that? So if we went with XX3, that would just be de facto, and then there is provisions within the code where if they wanted to do a critical area, that they could reduce the buffers based off of the mitigated, you know, mitigations, is what you're saying. Okay.
And also, if you have an existing home, there are allowances for certain structures and additions. So that's already taken care of to some extent.
Okay.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutback.
So my question is, can you go to the buffer, the map? So I have similar questions. I just want to make sure I understand. So is the purple right now, is that our current one or what's proposed on here?
That is what's proposed. Our current
200 feet for Category 1, the 150, the 150?
Yes.
That's what that is. What is our current? What do we currently do?
So our current, so our current buffers are 150, 100, 75, and 50.
Okay, so I guess the table, so what Department of Ecology is asking is that we pick a table rather than pick this over here, what we're proposing?
Yes.
And you guys talked about table XX3, which doesn't require any mitigation.
Correct.
And there it is. Why would we pick just 200 in the middle and not give the flexibility of 100 to 300?
So there are... Oh, sorry. So there are in the code, there are other issues in that we have mitigation requirements built in. This would, so if you look at the DOE's table, XX.2,
yeah,
a lot of those requirements are actually already in our code, and we can require them of any development application. But these also provide other requirements that we don't really contemplate now, such as noise, light, threats. I mean, you can address these sort of things with SEPA, but our code itself doesn't get into those specifics. If a range is appealing, that's obviously we need to discuss. This would just allow for within 100 to 300 feet. It's taking into consideration the type, the functionality of the wetlands we have currently. So DOE is looking at this, looking at the type of wetlands we have, and saying, okay, you know, you've got some issues with your wetlands, and so, you know, 200 feet is enough. They don't have any issues, by the way, with our categories 1 and 4. So it's more like category 2 should be 200 feet. So in some sense, we're trying to meet them in the middle, and this has been a negotiation.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out why just to set 200, 150, 100 is better than having a range and having a little bit more flexibility in there, and still then with table XX3 not requiring them to do a critical area study, which adds a huge amount of money onto the project. So, just asking the question. It always seems to me like a range allows more flexibility. For a project, it would seem like 100 feet versus 200 feet of a buffer makes a difference. Am I incorrect?
It's huge.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying that would seem like that would be a big amount. And having been through some projects and knowing about some buffers, you know, it can make a difference on the site of your property. If you can go to the green again, or to the map with the buffers, that darn thing is. Now that green is if it's the max at 300.
Yes.
So I mean, it's anywhere in between there, 1 to 300. It doesn't mean that it has to be 300.
And Brad just brought up a good point in that The problem we would have with the range is that you still need some sort of tool to determine where that
what it is. And we don't have that. And they don't have a criteria or list of how you would determine what the range, what it would be within the range.
It would be basically doing a critical area study and saying the actual specific functionality of this wetland is this. We are doing these measures to mitigate any impacts. Therefore, we get to go to the low one. If you don't want to spend the money, it's automatically the big one.
So the range 100, 300 really isn't a range unless you do the critical area study, even though we just said table XX3 doesn't require a critical area study.
Right.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Sorry. For me, it's my brain being sarcastic about myself. Anyways, go ahead.
So just to clarify before we go on to the next person, you've got three tables up there, the XX1, the XX3, and the city proposed. The city proposed is a fixed buffer. The XX3 and the XX1 each would allow an applicant to do a critical area study, and then as part of that critical area study, they identify the functions and values of the wetland. They could then do things like buffer width averaging. They could do things like enhanced buffers and things like that to get the buffer width smaller.
That's great.
Okay, and Planning Commission is recommending approval of the city proposed, which is just a one-size-fits-all. And part of the reason for that is because people, like developers that are doing multi-million dollar projects, might not want to spend $20,000 to $60,000 on a wetland delineation.
It was more oriented towards your standard resident who might want to do an addition. Another thing that to clarify that I neglected to point out is the buffer widths are also contingent upon the type of wetland you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So a bog might have one buffer, so it's not actually a range. There are values associated with each type of wetland, and you would need a critical area study to show which type of wetland you're dealing with. If that helps. So this was entirely decided and predicated on its impact on residents. Developers, when they, say someone's coming in for a plat, they're going to need, if there's a wetland on site, they're going to need a wetland study anyway because they need to delineate that because they're required to put that into an easement or a tract. So I don't believe it's going to preclude us from requiring developers to submit.
It would preclude them from being able to reduce the wetland buffer.
That's a separate process. So,
okay.
Yeah, and
I'll get it. Okay. We've got a couple more lights, and then I understand that you've got other items that want to cover also. Okay. Councilmember Scarborough? I'm sorry, Councilmember Cutterback, did you have anything further?
No.
Okay, Councilmember Scarborough?
Zach, I didn't hear your answer to Councilman Camp's question.
Can you repeat the question? I didn't hear you ask me a question. If your question goes to the extent to which these amendments might impact or bear somewhat on current litigation, that is a topic for executive session. I'd be happy to address that for council behind closed doors.
If we need to. Can we yield for a question? I'm just curious. Is there a time limit on this for adoption? Or did I miss it?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
So when you update your comp plan, you're also required to update your development regulations to comply with the comp plan update. My understanding is that Monroe did not update their critical areas ordinance at that time. So this is fulfilling some of that requirement, but it's not actually part of the periodic update process for the comp plan, so we're not on a stringent timeline.
Okay, so no fixed date, not being the same. Thank you, I appreciate it.
Councilmember Gamble, you have. I'm sorry, Councilmember Scarborough, so you have a little further. Councilmember Gamble, you have the floor now.
All right. So if I get what you're saying here, you still would need a critical area study for, if I'm looking at table XX3, because of the range 100 feet to a 300 feet, because you'd have to determine what type of Category 1 wetland it is, because there's differences in the ranges. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That was the state. No, I'm asking both of you.
But can't you just say, I don't want to do any studies, I just go to 300 automatically?
You can do that.
Yeah.
There are...
Okay, so you can go to the 300 automatically. So the other statement that was made was that a city proposed buffer of 200 feet, right? Is you said we're just kind of meeting them in the middle. That doesn't make sense to me. Wouldn't we have to go to the highest buffer that is categorized as a Category 1 wetland?
So we're not actually changing our Category 1 value. And ecology has no issue with what we're proposing with that. This is the number we have now. They were concerned about Categories 2 and 3. And also we're not changing 4. So
it's 2 and 3. So I get it. So it's 2 and 3, but the same question apply, right? Because what you're saying to me is that table dot 3 is that there's different types of Category 2 type wetlands.
Yes.
And that's why there is the difference in the range from 100 feet to 300 feet, right? But then what we're saying is, and that it would require a critical area study to determine what type of Category 2 wetland it is. But then what we're saying is the city proposed buffer of 150 feet, you don't need a critical area study.
Right.
But how can that be?
Because with the ecology standards, there are different buffer widths assigned to different types of wetlands, like very specific buffer widths.
Got it. Uh-huh.
And so in order to determine what type of wetland you have, you need a critical area study. So if you went with the range for ecology, that's the problem you're going to run into.
I guess then if that's the case, then we could set the city proposed buffers to 100 feet, 100 feet, 80 feet, and 50 feet, if we wanted to. What you're telling me?
If you want to draw the ire of ecology even more than they already have.
No, I'm trying to understand.
That is correct. We could propose that. Yeah.
We just kind of came in the middle.
Yeah, exactly.
If we go with the environment or the range, they have to do a critical area study. Mm-hmm. But if we say, you know what, we're just going to set a tried and true proposed buffer, then you don't have to do critical areas.
Right. And to come down this, we're not actually required to implement ecology's rating system. State law allows us to implement our own if we'd like, as long as it's regionally specific. So I don't know if that's something we would want to do. It's a lot of work. But this is a recommendation, ultimately. This isn't compulsory.
So of the Category 2, 100 feet to 300 feet, how many different types of wetlands, how many different types of Category 2 wetlands are there?
It's on the map, so...
No, I'm not so much.
Oh, how many are in the city?
Yeah.
Oh, it's one amalgamated designation. So we just, in the city, we only have the one. Ecology, I'd have to go check and get back to you. I don't have a copy of the study.
Okay. I'm just a numbers guy. I always have a hard time when you just pick a number because it's... it seems nice that it's in the middle. So that's what I'm struggling with, is all. Because I, like Councilmember Kovac, like to try to provide as much flexibility as we can. It makes sense from the wetlands perspective, but that also makes sense from the property owner. So, okay, I think.
Would you yield for a clarifying question? So could you just kind of summarize what exactly you're hoping for or looking for?
Well, what I was hoping for was, because that's what was originally presented, was that you could use table XX.3 and it didn't require a critical area study or mitigation, right? So that you could be anywhere in the 100 to 300. Since we've got clarification that no, you actually would need to do a critical area study. So that kind of takes that flexibility that we were looking at there. So then my question, because I still want to be able to provide that for citizens where they don't have to do, or developers where they don't have to do critical areas, you know, study if we set, you know, some number. And now I'm questioning, you know, the hard fast 200 feet, 150 feet, 100 feet and 50, and why did we, you know, come up with that? Because the statement was made that we just thought we'd meet them in the middle, right? I miss more of some sort of scientific answer to, to get us there, especially learning that we don't have to do that. We could actually go less than what they're saying is. And so I'm more inclined to go, you know, towards the low end of their table standards as the city proposed buffers. And then, if you wanted to go less than that, which is the XX1, 75, you know, down to 75 feet, you would go through the mitigation standards that are there. Because I just know that for being in the city limits, I mean, 200, a difference of 100 feet is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
Mr. Mosley?
Well, I would just like to make a suggestion for the council. This is a complicated issue, as you can see. We could go on like this for the next 4 hours, I think. What I would propose is that we table this, and, you know, we as staff will, and attorney, meaning the attorney also, will review this to see if we can bring a little more clarity to what your options are, and bring this back whenever it's ready. I won't promise it on the 21st because this is pretty complicated. And, but I'd suggest that we table this tonight to, I suppose we have to table it to a date certain, don't we?
Yes, if you table it, that in effect actually kills the entire item for the rest of this meeting. But if you were to continue to a date certain, or just by consensus decide to put it off until it's ready for draft.
Council, so we'll just do that by consensus. Council members, you okay with us bringing this back? There isn't a formal motion on the floor to table, so just go ahead and bring this back in a couple of weeks for more discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just want to say I'd like to express appreciation to staff for really working hard on this.
And absolutely.
It really is complicated. They've really had a lot of discussions with ecology, but it's not soup yet.
Thank you.
All right, next item that we have on the agenda this evening is final action number one. This is AB 17028, resolution number 006, 2017, regarding opposition to proposed marijuana retail licensure. 422745-7A. And I believe this would be Chief Windsor, is that correct? Yes, Chief Windsor.
On January 25th, 2017, the City of Monroe received a notice of marijuana license application from the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board for a new marijuana retailer application in the City of Monroe, and that would be located at 14697 Green Lake Road, Unit B. This resolution number 006/2017 would, if passed, authorize the mayor to express the city's opposition to the state's issuance of the marijuana retailer license number 422745-7A, and to also request a hearing. It is, however, at the board's sole discretion as to whether or to grant the local government's request for a hearing. This resolution would also accompany the city's response to the liquor cannabis board.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
I move to approve resolution number 006-2017, authorizing and directing the mayor to notify the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board of the city's opposition to the issuance of marijuana license 422745-7A, and to request an adjudicative hearing for a new final action on said license application is taken.
Second. I have a first from Councilmember Hanford, a second from Councilmember Davis for the requested action as listed in Agenda Bill numbers 17-2028. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 7-0. Thank you, everybody. All right, next item on the agenda is Council Member Reports. The Finance Committee was canceled this evening, so So we'll go on to Snohomish County Tomorrow Steering Committee. Councilmember Scarborough.
Well, I went to this meeting, and I'll tell you that about 70% of it went right over my head. So I'll give you what I understood as best I can, and you will go from there. They did several presentations, one on affordable housing, which I have a presentation that I can give to Liz and she can give to all of you care to hear it. They did one on congestion management, which I could understand the crust of which said they showed a 16-lane freeway in Houston, Texas, and said, build it and they will come, and it showed it full of cars. So the idea was, it doesn't matter how many lanes you build, you're going to get more cars. So it was a testimony from Sound Transit, basically, to think about alternate transportation, which is your meeting, I think, to some degree. But some of the other things presented at that meeting were the automakers' concern about the lack of selling cars in the future, about that's why they are getting into the driverless car production or development to some degree, farther because people can call, order a car, an Uber or a taxi that doesn't have a driver, show up at your house, pick you up, take you to the venue you want to go to and do the same to get home. You don't have to have a car. So they're concerned that at some point car dealers aren't going to be selling as many cars. And I guess that would have an impact on taxes collected by the state, etc. But it was an interesting presentation. I can't tell you that I understood it all, but that was the crux of it. I also have a presentation here that can be looked at if you want to see them. The other one was the PSRC Regional Centers Framework. Now, that's where things went right over my head. I can't even begin to regurgitate what that was about, so I can't help you. Sorry. And that was the crux of the whole meeting. It was interesting, to say the least, the things I could understand. And what we miss is Councilman Cutterback and I have agreed to do is I'll take this committee. She's got the Sound Transit, so
Community transit, excuse me.
And I'll take the rest of it. And I'm trying to look at this list of meetings, and one's on February 14th, and we've already decided that we're not doing anything on February 14th, and I'm not doing anything on you're not doing it. The other is something on February 16th, and I'll figure out if that's one I might go to or not. But if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Probably you got the short end of the stick.
So what's new, junior guy on the ground?
The bad seat.
Thank you, Councilmember Scarborough.
Yeah. Anytime.
All right, Community Transit Board of Directors, Councilmember Kovac.
Okay, I did attend this. Most of the meeting was actually for condemnation proceedings, so that took almost the whole meeting. 33 properties, and 17 were not agreed upon. And we had probably about five of them where public got up and spoke and had an issue with it. Most of them were on 164th and 527, I mean. And so 164th Bothell Everett Highway. And so it's for the Swift 2 line. There's already bus stops there, but then putting a bigger station so for the Swift 2 line. So that took quite a long time. So that was the majority of the meeting. Community Transit is having their advocacy day in Olympia on February 10th. Councilmember Christopher Boyer from Linwood was just appointed as another alternate to take George first place. It's interesting because Christopher Boyer, I guess he does a lot of work with the homeless and sits on committees and task force in Everett and is a council member in Linwood, a pastor there, but he's very well known in that arena, so it might be someone we can call, and I talked to him for quite a while that night. Not much else. The next meeting is the first Thursday in March. Just some community news that they put up. Jason Sanders was elected as appointed as the new council member in Milton Mesh recently, and then Mayor Nearing's son was just appointed for county council up in the Arlington area. So that was some news. And then we did have an executive session. What's listed on the agenda was review of the performance of a public employee. So that was basically the meeting, and CEO gave a report just on kind of what they're doing out in the community, and he really advocates that his staff has a large presence out in the community across the county where community transit is, and they're also looking at getting active shooter training for their staff and how to respond to that, so they're looking at that. And interesting, unfortunately, the night before the meeting on that Wednesday night, there was a stabbing in Everett at a community transit station. It didn't involve anyone on community transit. I think it was a sound transit situation, but their staff did respond and were able to respond appropriately and actually apprehend the person. So.
Thank you, Councilmember Cutback. We'll go ahead and go down the line, Councilmember Gamble.
So March 17th, it's coming quick. St. Patrick's Day, Monroe Public School Foundation. Just as a reminder for those that want to attend, I can get you tickets. I actually have room at my table. If anyone's interested, I know I've got one person that has expressed interest. Also looking for auction items. As a reminder, this all goes to scholarships for kids in the Monroe School District and Sky Valley Education Center, and then for other academic programs and assistance within the city of Monroe. And if you got any recommendations on auction items, or if you don't have auction items, maybe you're really good at making desserts, that'd be awesome. It's our single biggest fundraiser for the year and does a lot for kids in the community. So that is going on. I appreciate the homeless discussion today, Chief. Thanks for the presentation, and I just look forward to the continuing conversation. So that's it.
Thank you. Councilmember Cannon.
I said Cam.
You did?
Yeah,
I've been sick for the last week, so maybe that's getting in the way. That's what's confusing.
Not much. I attended the first chili cook-off, and I'm sure it will be spoken of by other people here, so I'm not going to say much about it, other than it was a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to next year's. That's it.
Thank you. Councilmember Davis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. A few items here. So last Monday we had a discussion with the health district here. David, Zach, Diane, and Jake, thank you for attending that. It was in regards to the potential sale of the Rucker building. As I mentioned earlier tonight, a lot of clarifying information that to look forward to bringing back on the 21st. And I know our city staff was going back and getting some additional information, which I believe has been found. So yeah, I do look forward to having that brought back to us and for further discussion on the 21st. And again, thank you for attending and being a part of that. The Jamie Bindle run, my oldest son and I had the opportunity to ride our bikes down, help set up for the run. That was a lot of fun, and good to see Councilmember Cutback and Mayor Thomas down there participating in it. And Mike helps her beating out the mayor on that one. So, yeah, it was just a lot of fun. Seeing everyone down there. So this chili bowl thing, that was a blast. And Councilmember Camp, Councilmember Scarborough, thank you for for coming. Mayor Thomas, thank you for being a judge on it. I just got to say that we spent the day earlier in the day passing out leaflets on flatulence awareness, and fortunately won that. So I told you I was going to get a joke in there. So there you go.
You didn't mention the word and people laugh.
I know. this was set for the intent with this was just to bring have a lot of fun as a community event, and it's okay, and just to get people aware and bring attention to some of the incredible community resources we have right behind us here, being the senior center, the club, and the food bank, and our chamber, and it was just really cool. About 200 people is what we estimated came through the doors of the senior center for this. 15 local businesses represented and participated in it. Lots of awareness brought forward. And great to see you out there. It was fun to see so many people out in a very casual setting. And it was just a fun night. Mayor Thomas for judging, along with County Council Member Sam Lowe and County Executive Dave Summers. Felt bad for Dave because I think he forgot to take a few notes on some of the judges or on some of the chefs and had to go back through multiple times. So at least that's what his excuse was. So again, look forward to next year on that, because that was just a ton of fun. And it definitely brought awareness to the resources that this community has down there. Board of Health Executive Committee meeting yesterday, and very simple. We talked about the record building, of course, and cities discussing that. The per capita ILA had some discussion on that, and I think if we don't respond, soon we'll be hearing from them asking follow up. So having that on the for additional conversation, 21st, 28th, or even in the March, I think is good. We're going to be welcoming a new board member, Nate Neary, next week, actually. Interviews for our new health officer to replace the retiring Dr. Bill Baumler continue. We're going to put out to a recruiting firm and hopefully find a great candidate. And again, this is a 75-25 split with Skagit County. So, and quickly, pass out kudos to our entire city staff for the work they've done in the last couple of days on managing the roads and the conditions out there with the snow and ice. It's been great. I mean, being able to still get around and get through the city. And probably start seeing stuff through social media or through the pipeline, but the shared parking lot between the club and the food bank, it's become a designated space for trees that fall during these storms that the city has to cut up are now being placed in this designated area between the club and the food bank for people that need firewood. So those in need can come in and pick it up when the trees are down and cut up and put there. So just a great addition to the community. That's it.
Thank you very much, Councilmember Rasmussen. Councilmember Hanford.
The only thing to have to say is I pass on my sympathy to Mrs. Thomas, Mrs. Camp, Mrs. Rasmussen, Mrs. Scarborough.
Wow.
More than that. It's good. Thank you.
Councilmember Cutterback.
Just Jamie Bindle run. It was great to go out there. I think I've done it the last few years, and it was great to see the community and see other corrections officers and police officers and other personnel from around the state. It's always a good run to do, and I think it's important to do it and remember. And Ben was also there with his family, so you got to give props to Ben.
That was right behind the chief.
The chief was
fast.
Thank you.
Councilmember Sternberg.
Well, I had a discussion, I don't remember who, with the chili cook-off, said maybe next time we ought to have a lasagna cook-off or something. It's a different menu, or menu. And the only other thing is they probably should have sold ice cream in addition to having a chili test. That's all.
Thank you, Councilmember Scarborough. Out to staff, directors, Mr. Worthen. Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mayor. Council, I just want to report to you that we had a process to build the new parks supervisor position. Mm-hmm. We had roughly about 10 applicants, internal and external, total interview folks, and Dale Olson, who's been working with the City of Monroe for the last 26 years, and he was our lead worker, is now our new park supervisor, so welcome him into that new role. And that opens up the lead worker position, so we actually are in a recruitment process internally for that position.
Thanks. Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
Under staff reports in your agenda there is the December year-end report, and I've been asked to report on this just because it's the year-end one rather than just one of our monthly ones. So if you can open that up, please, and take a quick look. We ended the year in a really good position, better than we anticipated, and I'd like to draw your attention on the first page where the general fund revenues are. If you look at licenses and permits, you can see that we budgeted $467,000 and we ended up with $837,000. So that was a great boom. The majority of that is building permits. Building permits came in at $661,000. We had budgeted $300,000 for that. So that was the lion's share of the jump there. Also, if you look at charges for goods and services, you can see it came in at $1.3 million. Most of that was building plan check fees. They came in at $363,000. The planning fees for zoning came in at $111,000. And we had budgeted $184,000 and $50,000 respectively on those two. So, there again, that shows that all the new residential construction that went on last year, the fiscal impact of that. Total general fund revenues came in at 107% of budget. Nice position to be in. General fund expenditures, your state and budgetary compliance, statutory compliance, and came in at 98% of budget. We did not go over budget on expenditures. If you look, you can see city attorney fees, we went over budget, but that's something that's really hard to guess. It just depends on what comes up during the year. And a good point that David made earlier was that all this growth in, with the building permits and the planning fees and plan check fees, a lot of that we have to refer to the city attorney on land use issues. And so even though the attorney fees are up, we had revenues that corresponded to that. Also, if you look at the planning and building department expenditures, they came in under budget, and a lot of that had to do with we had budgeted $50,000 for temporary help that we did not use, and health insurance for that department came in $10,000 under what we had budgeted. And also, there was $7,700 for a land use attorney that we did not use. So that was a nice savings there that we came in under budget. On the next page, if you look at, there's just a few things there. The real estate excise tax revenues, there again, it's that residential boom that we're starting to see. We budgeted $500,000 for REIT taxes and came in at $953,000. Water CIP fund and sewer CIP fund, both way over budget. In their revenues, and that again is capital connection charges of new residences coming onto the system. I just wanted to point out where storm drain CIP fund revenues are. You can see we budgeted $3.2 million and only got $7,000. And that is strictly because we had budgeted for issuing some storm bonds that we decided not to issue. So that was a planned difference variance in the budget. And then all the other funds, they came in under budget, so we are in statutory compliance. And we ended it up very nice. That's the position.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nelson.
That's it.
Chief Windsor. I'm sorry, Mr. Feilberg, and then Chief Windsor.
If you recall, we've been talking about the 850 houses in the pipeline for a couple of years now, and so I've recalculated that, and we are now up to, starting in 2014, we're up to 991 houses. Currently, there's approximately about 110 active single-family building permits out there, and the lots that are either in final plat, preliminary plat, plat application or pre-app for 758 lots. So that's why there's lots of money there, because there's lots of stuff happening out there. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Windsor.
I want to go off Sergeant Irvin's presentation a little bit. One of the important things I don't think was stressed enough as far as the law enforcement action that we take, there's a vast difference between taking action on city property and private property, and I can't stress that enough. It's almost direct opposites as far as the steps that we have to take in life. So, but other than that, I would like to commend the sergeant for the presentation he made. I thought it was great, and you'll never know how nervous he was.
Did a good job. For a nervous guy,
thank you, Chief. All right, up at me real quick. I see we're coming up. The week before last, we had probably about 25 people were signed up at the 191st community open house. Was there the whole time, and just a lot of people coming through, showing a lot of interest, and the staff will be coming forward to give an update on what the comments were, both, I think, in social media, where we did have them, and also the comments we received while we were there. There were a lot of people that really appreciated the fact that even though they knew that this wasn't going to lead to immediate construction, like tomorrow, that knew that this was, or understood that this was sort of the first step in the process. Council needs to select which route they'd like to go, and then we can begin the whatever the next stage is, start to populate the money for design and whatnot at a level that allows us to do a better job of dialing in the costs. Also did the Benville Run, a lot of fun. It was great seeing so many people there, including staff and council members there. Food bank, last week I volunteered at the food bank occasionally, and last Monday we had a much higher number of people that went through than normal. So that was interesting, seeing so many people go through that particular day. Chili cook-off was great. I probably ate as much chili as I normally do at home, but all the mix of spices was different because there were so many different chilies. But it was great seeing so many people there and a lot of wonderful chilies that we tasted. As you've already seen here, and if anybody pays attention to social media, over the last 2 weeks after I made a post thanking staff for working on and thanking council for supporting the embedded social worker, there were a number of pictures put up on social media and shared of property on the other side of the river, and then also the Highway 2 bypass, showing the, you know, the encampments and garbage left over at different locations. And so I worked very closely with staff to make that a priority the last couple of weeks, and as I've said, you know, kudos to the staff for all the work that they've done to meet certain goals, to meet certain timelines that I requested, It allowed us to have a very good conversation with Paula Peek on Thursday last week, despite being very, very sick. I met with her last Thursday evening, and we had a really good conversation with her and explained how she needed to contact the county since she was in the county. Her thing is in the county, and Councilmember Sam Lowe was there, and Darcy was there also, his aide, and PD and our interim city administrator was there. She left and made some really positive comments about the meeting in social media, and hopefully she can get resolution to the things that she's having issues within the county, and we'll continue to work on things here in the city and coordinate with the county as appropriate. And then that same night, Cub Scouts, we had a mock city council meeting here. The Cub Scouts decided to receive a staff report on a proposal that they have popcorn that tastes like cake, vanilla cake, and there was a nice debate up here, and you'll maybe be happy to know that they decided that chocolate cake was the way to go with sprinkles on it, on the popcorn. So that was fun. Yes. This coming week, I have karaoke that I'm doing for a fundraiser for the YMCA on Thursdays. I encourage everybody to come and donate, and when you see me get up to sing the Time Warp, then everybody can come up and sing with me so you can't hear my lack of ability to carry a tune. So that is at, that's Thursday. No, I'm not dressing in costume. So that is Thursday.
You don't want to know what Councilmember Hanford said.
Very well, I don't. So that'll be Thursday at Bella Bellucci's at, is it
7?
So I am looking forward to that, and again, I'm not looking forward to singing, except it's for a good cause. That's all I have really to report right now. We're coming up with 2 minutes left, so this is mostly done for you.
Okay, I suppose someone will shut me up and we can kind of block
out. Or we'll extend.
So one thing that I wanted to express, your packet has information from our lobbyists, our Olympia lobbyists, and at the last meeting on the 26th, there was a discussion about and request from council and the mayor that I contact the lobbyists to see what was going on in Olympia as it related to the marijuana bill, and as he's expressed, I think it was last session and this one, there is a bill, House Bill 10, substitute House Bill now, 1099, and it's awkwardly worded, but what the bill, the new section of this bill, what the bill does, it says the local government that has not adopted an ordinance or resolution that expressly prohibits the siting and operation of state-licensed marijuana retail outlets within the city. And so if you have adopted a ban, the rest of this doesn't apply to you. If you have adopted a ban, then the financial implications of not issuing
Council members, it's 10 o'clock. We are nearly done with the meeting. Could I have a motion to extend past 10? We have a motion from Councilmember Cutback to extend past 10. Is there a second? I don't think we'll be more than a couple minutes here.
Second.
Okay, a second from Councilmember Rasmussen. Any discussion on the motion to extend past 10 briefly? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Okay, the names were Councilmember Kim and Councilmember Gannon.
Just continue.
Anybody else? Okay, motion passes 5-2. Please continue.
Okay, I think I've said what I need to say on this. The bill 1099 this would not apply to us. We have expressly a ban on all marijuana sales within the city of Monroe.
Joke. I'm sorry. That was a joke.
It's going to the courtroom.
That's it, Mayor.
Thanks.
In the interest of time, that's it.
Okay, so we have an agenda. Remember, no meeting next week. You can take a look at the extended agenda and the agenda for the week of the 21st. Reminder, a couple of us are going down to AWC. Who's going to AWC on the 15th and 16th?
Am I on the list? There's only go Wednesday.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't need a hotel.
Okay.
Or we can talk after.
Okay, sounds good. All right. If you have any questions or concerns about the extended agenda, please get a hold of me or Mr. Mosley. And do we have anything else for seeing? All right, we have no other needs to continue the meeting this evening. Is there a motion to adjourn? Motion from Councilmember Rasmussen to adjourn, and a second from Councilmember Hamill. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion passes 7-0. Thank you very much. Have a great evening. Thank you for your service. Have a happy Valentine's Day. We're adjourned.